This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Good morrow, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Let's start the week off right, shall we? Well, I am somebody that loves a good mystery. In my view, that's really what overnight radio is all about, is exploring the unknown, the world of mysteries. And the only thing I like better than exploring mysteries and exposing them and telling you about maybe something that you thought you knew about but you actually didn't, and raising some questions about it, the only thing I enjoy doing more than that is actually providing answers to those questions. Well, I am just thrilled. We are joined for the entire hour by a gentleman who has made an art out of answering questions to deeply held secrets and long-kept mysteries. We are joined by best-selling author, distinguished investigative journalist, and the author of a brand new book, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, the one and only Mark Shaw. Mark, thank you so much for staying up late with us this morning or this evening.
Hey, Frank, thanks for the nice words about me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for all the great work you've done, not only in this book, but in your previous works as well. Before we get into your newest book, which is called Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe, JFK, and Dorothy Kilgallen. Before we get into this, I think it's important to remind people about your work with respect to the investigation of Dorothy Kilgallen. Now, some of our listeners who are a little older may remember Dorothy Kilgallen from her work on the printed page. They may also remember her from being a New York radio personality on another great New York radio station, WOR, or her work on television at the time. But for people that may be a little younger, remind folks who Dorothy Kilgallen was and your initial research in your book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, about why her death may have been the result of something suspicious rather than what we were told at the time.
Well, thanks, Frank. You know, I didn't know anything about Dorothy Kilgallen when I began this. Actually, this new book will be the fifth time that I've touched on things with the assassination, but I really didn't know anything about her. Until I got into looking at the assassination, I actually practiced law with a famous lawyer in San Francisco, Melvin Belli, who represented Jack Ruby at trial. And when I was investigating his life and times and getting ready to publish a book called Court of the King of the Courtroom, there was a clue given to me about Dorothy that propelled me into looking into this woman. And I'm like everybody else. When I was growing up, I remember What's My Line, an intellectual a quiz show that was on CBS every Sunday night for, I think, 20 years or something like that, live. And for those that don't remember, and by the way, there's hundreds of episodes up now on the Internet, but basically they guessed, it was a panel show, and they guessed people's unusual occupations. There was one that a woman sold dynamite and things like that. But Dorothy spread out her gifts. She was a college dropout. She rose to the top of the celebrity list with What's My Line, but she was also an investigative reporter. She had a gossip column called Voice of Broadway. She was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country.
Wow.
And I quickly learned then even more that she had covered the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case that became the movie The Fugitive, and of course, I think, is the most credible reporter to have ever covered the JFK assassination, because she was actually at the Jack Ruby trial. She was the only one to have investigated him. And then if that wasn't enough, she raised three children while she had a radio show, as you say, on WOR. So the New York Post at the time kind of summed up this incredible woman by saying she was the most powerful female voice in America. And I think that was an accurate statement at the time.
So what were we told about her death at the time in the 60s? Yeah. And why is that inaccurate?
Right. Well, when I began to look into what was going on with Dorothy, after she was at the Ruby trial. She ended up deciding whatever Ruby told her. She went to New Orleans. She investigated a mafia don that she believed was responsible for the JFK assassination, to basically for revenge of what Bobby Kennedy had done as attorney general, deporting him. And so she was on the ball with regard to that, Frank. And then she went back to New York and she said, you know, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it would cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I'm getting a gun. And about a week later, she was found dead over there on East 68th Street in a townhouse she had in a bedroom she never slept in. She had on her eyelashes, her hairpiece, and her makeup that never wore that to bed. When the police came, they found her, you know, found her dead. Her hairdresser first found her, but she was found dead. And they found an empty Secanol bottle on the night table. And just, I think, said to themselves, well, here's another celebrity that overdosed. And so they went ahead, and that was the verdict by the medical examiner. Now, in the new book, Collateral Damage, I include an interview that I had about 6 months ago with Dr. Michael Bodden, who I was surprised to learn had his name on the autopsy.
Wow.
And so I got him to finally admit that they had no idea really what had happened. Remember, the verdict actually was an overdose of barbiturates, circumstances undetermined. But as we'll learn in Marilyn's death, basically the media just took off with whatever verdict they wanted to, and so they said she died of an overdose. There was absolutely no investigation at the time, and so I've been fighting over the last few years to try to get that done. Cyrus Vance was going to do it. He didn't do much. But I can tell you something you may not know, and that is that about, 4 weeks ago, I guess, I got a voicemail from a detective named Philip Panzarella with the New York Cold Case Squad, telling me that he was going to look into Dorothy's death. So we corresponded some, and I talked to him a couple times, and then I sent him all of the evidence that I had in both the reporter who knew too much and the follow-up, but denial of justice. And as far as I know now, they are going to investigate Dorothy's death. So I'm pleased that that's happened.
Well, that's encouraging, and it's a testament to your work in the two books, which are still worth reading, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice. I'm curious, aside from that reaction from law enforcement, what has the reaction been like to your first two books with respect to what you've published about the Kilgallen murder and the fact that she might have been killed because of her work trying to expose the truth about the Kennedy assassination? What, if anything, have you heard from other law enforcement entities, from anybody that was associated with Dorothy or her family, and maybe even anybody associated with the Kennedy family?
Yeah, in that situation, you know, and it's we're going to look at similarities with Marilyn's death, because in Collateral Damage, I found almost 50 similarities, and I'll tell you how that happened. But
yeah.
The first thing I did, you know, I'm a former criminal defense lawyer and a legal analyst for the networks on some big trials and things like that. I always looked at motive. And when I found out that looking at some forensics, that there wasn't just one barbiturate in Dorothy's stomach, there were three. They had done some tests later by saving some of her bodily fluids, and that they found some residue of phenobarbital on a lid of a glass there. That made no sense for somebody who would, you know, have overdosed that particular way. So I think that I was able to pretty much prove in the Reporter Who Knew Too Much, which became a bestseller, that she was murdered. So I started looking at why that happened, and it really came down to the fact that she had to be silenced by those people who had orchestrated the JFK assassination. A real break came when I found a detective, I think it was the Sussex County Police Department or the Sheriff's Office, I believe, as I remember. He got in touch with me, and he was really in tune with the theories that I had. He actually knew one of the forensic guys who did the later tests on Dorothy, and so he was able to substantiate the fact that it looked to him like murder as well. And then we looked at a suspect, main suspect, who's still alive today, Ron Pataki, lives in Columbus, Ohio. He was a confidant of Dorothy's and really knew about her JFK assassination evidence. And we believe from the evidence that we found that he leaked that information to what we would call the wrong people.
Mm.
And in the new book, Collateral Damage, I actually found a source who told me that Pataki himself, who he was a journalist in the Midwest, had gotten in trouble. And the wrong people, again, and we can go into who that is, but the wrong people came to him and said, look, we can get you out of the trouble you're in, but you got to tell us what Kilgallen is going to put in that book she's writing for Random House.
Wow.
And as this source said to me, you know, Mark, when he told them what she was going to write, that she was going to implicate Marcello for the orchestration of JFK's death and J. Edgar Hoover for covering up, she was dead.
And based on your further research, does the Kilgallen theory that Marcello was responsible for the Kennedy assassination and that J. Edgar Hoover was largely responsible for covering up the JFK assassination, does that seem to hold true based on your research?
Yeah, I think most people who've read those books and experts and things like that have come back to me believing that that happened. You know, I looked at the JFK assassination, frankly, different than anybody ever had. This was based on a good conversation I had with Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander. When I asked him about JFK's death, he said, well, I didn't think he'd be killed. I thought it'd be Bobby Kennedy because he had many more enemies than JFK. And so I came up with a theory that what you need to do is to look at why Bobby Kennedy was not killed in 1963 instead of why JFK was. And when you do that, you see the motive for killing JFK so Bobby would be powerless, because if you kill Robert Kennedy, JFK would come after you with everything the Justice Department had. But if you kill JFK, Bobby would be powerless, and
right.
That's exactly what happened. They never bothered those guys again.
We're talking with Mark Shaw. He's a veteran investigative journalist, an attorney, best-selling author. His latest book, which came out on June 1st, the 95th birthday, what would have been the 95th birthday of Marilyn Monroe, is Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination. We will take some of your calls throughout the course of the hour. If you have calls for Mark about his work, his research, his methodology here, or his findings, you can give us a call 1-800-848-9222, 1-800-848-WABC. All right. Before we get into the who and the how of Marilyn Monroe's killing, we've heard a great deal over the years about Marilyn Monroe having an illicit romantic relationship with both John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Additionally, we've heard that she had a romantic relationship with Chicago mobster Momo Giancana. Now, this is the kind of thing that's repeated so often, I think many people just assume it's fact. Based on your research, before we get into her death, is that a fact? Did she indeed have a romantic relationship with all three of those individuals?
Well, let me just stop one of those theories right away. That the Giancana thing is not Marilyn. That's just not her. She was never involved with him. Let me explain a little bit about why this book was written, because I was not going to write it, Frank. And hopefully now I have resolved three true crime murder mysteries in the book. But I wasn't going to write it because I was done after Denial of Justice. I'd done what I could for Dorothy and everything else. And so I wasn't going to, but I had all these, listeners, programs like yours and supporters and people emailing me from around the world. Is there a connection between Marilyn and Dorothy and their deaths and their life and times and everything else like that? And so I began to look into that, and I found that there were connections. I have in the book, columns by Dorothy about Marilyn. Marilyn had been to Dorothy's home or over on East 68th Street for parties. They knew each other. And so I started to look, and, I always had in the back of my mind, it just didn't, jive with me that she would have committed suicide, because it just didn't seem like to me that that's something Marilyn would have done. So I started to look into that. And to answer your question, and then I'll tell you how I came around to it, there's no question that she had an affair with John F. Kennedy. Most people remember that, Frank. She sang Happy Birthday
Sure.
to him over there in Madison Square Garden, but that love affair was very short-lived. And so when I started looking into that, after I decided that there was something, or basically Dorothy in a column had decided there was something suspicious about Marilyn's death, I turned my attention to Bobby Kennedy. And I can kind of give you the journey as to how I ended up with Bobby Kennedy being the main, suspect in her death. I just want to read you one thing that Dorothy wrote just the day before Marilyn passed away. Marilyn's health must be improving. She's been attending Hollywood parties, has become the talk of the town. She's cooking in the sex appeal department. She's proved vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio. That was her former husband in his heyday. So don't write off Marilyn is finished. I found a quote from her masseur that she had at the time. That was, she was looking the best she had in years, and her publicist, she's in good spirits. And so just like you, a curious guy, as you are always looking for the truth, I started to really wonder what was going on with Marilyn, and that's when I really started to look into her life and times and her death.
All right, we're going to pause here. We will continue with your calls, and we'll find out who was responsible, based on Mark Shaw's research, for Marilyn Monroe's death, and how that death ties in to the killings of John F. Kennedy, Dorothy Kilgallen, and maybe even Robert Kennedy. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll continue with Mark Shaw straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
One second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Up,
I want to go. Go.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, a terrific song from Inside Llewyn Davis. And if you listen to these guys singing about going into space, it really makes you appreciate what a decade the 1960s was. It was a decade where people started looking towards the future. It was a decade in which it became clearer and clearer that the United States was the world's only superpower. But as we've seen with the deaths of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and others, it was also an incredibly violent period in our history where we saw race riots, where we saw all sorts of things. And a gentleman who has really caused a great deal of controversy with his work investigating the death of Dorothy Kilgallen is Mark Shaw. He's an attorney, veteran investigative journalist, and a best-selling author. And in his new book, Collateral Damage, he makes a pretty compelling case that the death of Marilyn Monroe is pretty directly tied to the deaths of John F. Kennedy and Dorothy Kilgallen. All right, Mark. Bottom line, Marilyn Monroe, if she didn't commit suicide, if she didn't get hopped up on drugs and kill herself that way, what exactly happened based on what you've learned?
All right. Let's remember this. Those three people you mentioned died within 40 months of each other. Many people don't realize that. Marilyn died in 62, JFK in 63, Dorothy in 65. I didn't realize that. Well, they did. And so once I had the suspicions about, you know, Marilyn's death, I mean, with what Dorothy Kilgallen had written and that she wasn't in bed, humor or anything, or depressed and all that, the first thing I did is what I think you would do. You looked at the autopsy. And the first autopsy that they had said she died of an acute barbiturate poisoning ingestion of an overdose. I have it right in front of me. Well, then I looked. Excuse me, I dropped my papers.
Sure.
Then I looked at 5 hours later, and the verdict was probable suicide. Not suicide, but probable suicide. Now, I interviewed Dr. Cyril Weck, who's probably the foremost forensic scientist.
Sure, he's been a guest on this show several times.
Sure. Yeah. And he told me this. I've looked at 16,000 autopsies. I never saw one that said probable suicide. So that really got me going. And then I looked at, you know, trying to see what Dorothy Kilgallen wrote about it. And after that verdict, Frank, she basically wrote a column called, you know, that was basically with people who had mailed her questions and everything. Why was Marilyn's door locked that night? Why was the light on? She never slept with a light on. Why was she found in the nude? You know, all kinds of questions about the death and made me wonder about the questions in terms of what happened. And so I just began going through what I could learn about what was happening to Marilyn at that particular time. And it wasn't JFK who was the new man in her life or anything. It was RFK. So I started looking at that situation as to what kind of a relationship there was. The first thing I came across was a letter that just socked me in the jaw from Jean Kennedy Smith, JFK's sister. Understand that you and this is to Marilyn. Understand that you and Bobby are the new item. We all think you should come back with him when he comes east. Thanks, Jean Kennedy Smith. Then there was a CIA document that I found that was just after Marilyn died. Robert Kennedy has been having a romance and a love affair, sex affair over a period of time with Marilyn Monroe. Robert Kennedy was deeply involved emotionally with Marilyn Monroe, and he repeatedly promised to divorce his wife to marry Marilyn. So these kind are the kind of things that were going on in her mind. And then there was that smoking gun that all investigative reporters look at and try to find. And I found a CIA document that was that was issued on the day before Marilyn died, and it's just amazing. It talks about wiretapping of a Marilyn Monroe Dorothy Kilgallen call. First of all, it talks about, I just heard you talking about UFOs. It talks about JFK, Marilyn, and Dorothy's obsession with UFOs. And then it goes into the fact that there was an event that Marilyn went to just before she died, and there was apparently some mix-up in terms of what was going to happen at this party, that Marilyn felt like she was going to be passed around by Sinatra, the two Kennedys, all that kind of thing. She was furious. She left there, and the document that I'm talking about says subject Marilyn threatened to hold a press conference and would tell all. And then it says the subject made reference to bases in Cuba and knew of the president's plan to kill Castro. Well, it doesn't take much logic to realize that if she threatened to go to the media about the love affairs with JFK and RFK, that would be one thing. But they had apparently, for whatever reason, pillow talk or whatever, or trying to impress her, had shared matters of national security. And so I said to myself, well, Bobby Kennedy's not going to let that happen. And so I began to keep going forward, and I found these documents. The book is all about documents. I found a couple, couple of FBI files that talked about the relationship, him promising Marilyn he would marry her. And then basically what happened is that just like JFK had dumped her, Bobby dumped her. She was going to go to the media. And as we get close to August 1962, they cannot let that happen. The biggest problem I faced is that Bobby had an alibi being up in San Francisco. And yeah, he wouldn't have had to have been in, you know, right there when Marilyn died. But I wondered if I could, you know, do something with that. And I found actually a ledger over at 20th Century Fox that talked about the fact that he was in the city at that time. That he landed in a helicopter with Peter Lawford, and he was there on the day that Marilyn died. I found a Beverly Hills Police Department officer who stopped a car with not only Peter Lawford driving and Bobby in the back seat, but Marilyn's psychiatrist in the front seat too. So he obviously was there. And so I tried to look at exactly then how Marilyn died, getting around to your question. And that is that initially they thought she had ingested 40 to 50 pills within the time she took them and the time she died. Well, there was a police detective on the scene, the first guy there, who said that was impossible. There were some questions about what kinds of substances were in her stomach. I found from the autopsy that there was a bruise on her left hip. I questioned what the housekeeper was doing in the middle of the night when they found Marilyn's body in her bedroom. She was doing the wash. And all of these questions lead me to giving the reader in Collateral Damage a plausible account of how I think Marilyn died, based on the fact that I proved that on that day that she died, Peter Lawford and Bobby Kennedy went to her home and begged her not to go to the media about the love affairs and about the national security secret she had. And as it almost in just exactly like what happened with Dorothy, when I had a source there that was very close to what happened, he said when she threatened to go to the media with all of that information, she was dead.
So we think Robert Kennedy killed, directly or indirectly, obviously it sounds like indirectly, Robert F. Kennedy killed Marilyn Monroe.
That's exactly right. And he wouldn't have done it himself. So operatives, and I give a plausible scenario as to how those operatives went to the home and all of that. I can just give you, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen was a great investigative reporter because she looked at the little things that made sense. And there's a number of them I could give you, but I'll just give you one. There's an FBI memo that talks about a book that had come out in 1964. And it was written by a guy named Frank Capel, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. And that book is 78 pages long, has a red cover on it. I've got a copy of it right here. And he basically just blasts, Bobby Kennedy for the kind of person he was. He writes, the ruthlessness of this man, his utter disregard for the rights of others is frightening. He does not hesitate to try to embarrass and even disgrace the president and so on and so forth. He really gets after Bobby. But he, again, provides all of this documentation where Bobby stayed when he was in L.A. that summer, all of the different kinds of things that were going on. And so that book was released, and I have the FBI memos that they actually went ahead and got copies of it. They sent it to Bobby Kennedy saying, here's the allegations that are in the book. What are we going to do about it? Some of them apparently don't make any sense, but Mr. Kennedy, many of them we think probably are true about the love affair and so on and so forth that way. And what Dorothy would have done is the same thing that I did. I looked at that, and then I found an FBI memo that said basically that the Kennedys and members of the FBI were told, go out and buy as many copies of that book as you can, confiscate them, so nobody will be able to read the damn book. And that's what they did. And so, you know, that shows how scared they were of this Capel book coming out that would have basically just, even in that day and age, without the internet and social media, it would have been big news and destroyed the careers of Bobby Kennedy and probably John Kennedy.
That's pretty wild, pretty groundbreaking, and there's a lot of documentation here in this book, as you point out. And again, if you're interested in this story of how Robert Kennedy might have been responsible for the death of Marilyn Monroe and how that decision and the handling of the aftermath of that Marilyn Monroe death may have actually led to the killing of President Kennedy and to the killing of Dorothy Kilgallen, want to encourage you to check out the book Collateral Damage. You can get it at markshawbooks.com or wherever books are sold. It's out this week. It's brand new. Everybody is talking about it. When we come back, we're going to find out how that death of Marilyn Monroe might have led to the death of John F. Kennedy. If you have questions, we'll try and get to you as soon as we can. 1-800-848-9222. We're talking with Mark Shaw. He's the author of the book Collateral Damage, a best-selling author, attorney, investigative journalist. He is my guest for the hour. 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The power of information at your fingertips. Download the 77 WABC mobile app now.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community and also the Army National Guard. Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the New York Army National Guard. Aired by the New York State Broadcasters Association and this station.
The perfect gift for Father's Day. An international thriller with elements of romance and detective novels. Years after the death of his gangster father, a young man defies the mob while searching for hidden treasure. Read the international suspense thriller, a detective novel from Jeffrey S. Stevens, Fool's Errand. A perfect gift for Father's Day. New York Trend exclaims Fool's Errand is poignant and entertaining, humorous and exciting, romantic and mysterious. An adventure that explores the relationship between a father and son and the events that will ultimately lead that young man to discover both the treasure and himself. Diane Taylor from Living Las Vegas exclaims, "The book was just pure pleasure." And as readers of this column know, not typically drawn to novels, but Fool's Errand is definitely an exception. Read the international suspense thriller, a detective novel, from Jeffrey S. Stevens, Fool's Errand, the perfect gift for Father's Day. Available wherever books are sold. If you need a new car and have bad credit, Hudson Hyundai can help. Call Hudson Hyundai at 800-721-8538. Tier 1 customers can drive a new Hyundai with just $68 down. They're loaded with inventory. Over 850 vehicles in stock. 800-721-8538. Like a Hyundai Tucson, only $68 down. The Hyundai Santa Fe, $68 down. Even a Hyundai Palisade, $68 down. Call 800-721-8538. Don't get tricked into paying more. They've got plenty of inventory and plenty of discounts. 800-721-8538. Over 850 vehicles in stock. Call 800-721-8538. All new Hyundais come with Hyundai Assurance and America's best 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. Drive now with just $68 down. They're loaded with inventory. Over 850 vehicles in stock. 800-721-8538 or HudsonHyundai.com. Payments will vary. Credit severity affects approval terms. See dealer for details.
Remember, on this record, we're trying to answer Senator McKinley's hit record. And, George, you have a word here?
All right, Senator, this one's for the Democrats, so let's really hear it.
All right, I think I'm about as ready as I'm ever going to be.
Okay, stand by. This is Wild Thing, take 72. Senator?
Wild Thing. You make my heart sing. You make everything groovy. Wild Thing. A Wild Thing, I think I love you.
This is Wild Thing, as sung by Senator Bobby. It was actually a novelty record that came out back in 1967. Comedian William Bill Minkin gave his best impression of Robert Kennedy doing Wild Thing. We've been talking with Mark Shaw. He's the author of a brand new book out this week, which everybody is talking about, called Collateral Damage. And in this book, he draws a pretty strong connection. It's all based on primary sources and authentic documents, a pretty strong connection between the death of Marilyn Monroe, the death of John F. Kennedy, and the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. All right, Mark, you explained how and why you believe that Robert Kennedy was responsible for the death of Marilyn Monroe. How then does the death of Marilyn Monroe lead to the death of John F. Kennedy in November of 1963?
Well, I lay out everything in the book like a prosecutor would. I've done that in the other books as well. And I did have an advantage here, and it's kind of an unusual one, if I may say so. I did this ass backwards, which I have done with a lot of things in my life. But if you think about it, you would first investigate Marilyn's death. She died first, then JFK, then Dorothy. Well, I had already investigated JFK's first and then Dorothy. And so then I decided to investigate Marilyn's. But instead of backfiring on me, that just opened up a great window, not only into what happened to Marilyn, but also what happened to JFK and Dorothy. And, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm looking at the historical aspects of this. And you've been saying, of course, and I understand why you want to, that Bobby Kennedy might have killed Marilyn Monroe. He did kill Marilyn Monroe. Now, that's figuratively speaking, but he was responsible for her death. The motive is just so strong there. Who else in the world would have wanted to stop her from going to the press with what, you know, not only the love affair, but also these matters of national security? So he was responsible. And then he got his good friend, William Parker, the police chief in Los Angeles, to cover it up by never investigating, never going to talk to witnesses, never doing anything with a staged death scene again. But what they did is Parker appointed three psychiatrists to a panel, and they looked at Marilyn's mental state before she died. Predictably, they came back and said that she was suicidal, and that was the end of the story. And so, you know, what I started to do is try to, it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle, but once I had figured out that Marilyn was obviously silenced because of what she knew. She was the actress too much who knew too much, just like Dorothy was the reporter who knew too much. Here's what I found. If Bobby Kennedy, and I'm going to go slow with this because I think it's very, very important to realize, and it'll give your listeners something to think about. If Bobby Kennedy would have been prosecuted in 1962 for the murder, the complicity in the murder of Marilyn Monroe, based on all of the evidence at the time, he would have had to have resigned as Attorney General. He would have been powerless. If you agree with that that statement that I'm making, that conclusion, then you stretch it out, because if he was already powerless, then those mafioso, especially Carlos Marcello, who killed the president so Bobby would be powerless, would not have had to do that because he would have been already powerless. And then you can stretch that on into the fact that Dorothy Kilgallen in 1965 would have never have been silenced for what she knew about the JFK assassination, because there would have been no JFK assassination for her to have investigated. So collateral damage, the abuse of power, what Bobby Kennedy did not only with his persecution, I would call it, of the mafia, but then his involvement in Marilyn's death resulted in the deaths of JFK and then Dorothy Kilgallen.
Well, look, I mean, it does stand to reason if then, and it's a pretty logical sequence of events and it makes a whole lot of sense. A lot of people have been eager to chat with you, and I've been monopolizing your time. If you want to call in with a question for Mark Shaw, you can do so, 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Joe in Queens has been patiently holding. Hello there, Joe.
Hey, Mark, very interesting stuff. First of all, Dorothy would have known, as she was doing her investigation, about the many people that had been witnesses or had something to do with, the periphery of the actual assassination had already been knocked off. So I wonder why she proceeded with all that. And if she had other confidence besides, say, her boyfriends, maybe people that had weren't players but were just friends where you could have gotten information. And then it sounds like the woman that was washing blood in the case of Marilyn Monroe's, I would ask also, did Marilyn have, besides Joe DiMaggio, did she still have a relationship with him? And, at the time, or other people that would have maybe known something about the trajectory she was on.
Good. Three questions. With JFK, and with Dorothy and with Marilyn, but especially JFK and Marilyn, I've gotten sick and tired, frankly, of all these rumors out there and the Wikipedia stuff and all that other kind of stuff about these two individuals and what happened to them. First of all, with JFK, Dorothy Kilgallen is the most credible reporter to have covered the JFK assassination. You can read her columns and everything that she wrote. The Oswald file must not close a few days after he died. Those are up on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org. So she was genuine, and she had, unfortunately, she told everybody when she got back to New York after New Orleans, I'm going to crack this case wide open and all that, and that cost her life. With Marilyn, Marilyn was portrayed as a dumb blonde. Well, she wasn't a dumb blonde. And, she was a voracious reader, for instance. I quote in the new book, there's a book about her called Fragments, and I give the cover in there and everything. She wrote poetry. She wrote little short stories. She wrote all kinds of things on hotel stationery and different things like that. For God's sake, she read Ulysses. I can't even read Ulysses. But she was mischaracterized that way, and that's always bothered me. And then they didn't know what happened to her when she died, just like they didn't know what happened to Dorothy. But I put the headline in there. You know what the headline was the day she died, the day after she died? Marilyn kills self. And it went into the drugs and all that. They just butchered these two women with these false rumors all of these years. And people may wonder, why am I interested in this? Well, I've become their voices. I found a quote that I keep by my writing table. The dead cannot obtain justice for themselves. It is the duty of the living to do it. And we must do that. We can't let these reputations of these two women, especially these remarkable women, you know, be tarnished on and on and on and on. I've written a long letter now to the Los Angeles District Attorney, Los Angeles District Attorney, with a 300-page evidence report and the book and everything, and said, come on, please open up a reinvestigation. This woman does not deserve to be looked upon as somebody who committed suicide. Your second question. She had hoped right before she died that she might remarry Joe DiMaggio. They had kept in touch. I have a wonderful picture in the book of Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio Jr. They were very good friends. And all really Marilyn wanted to do in her life was have a child. And she hoped that that could happen. So, you know, she lost that when she died. Dorothy lost being with her three children when she died. And all the things she could have done in the future. JFK, you know, look at him. He never was able to play with John and Caroline and all that. These are tragic deaths that took place, and they shouldn't have. And they wouldn't have, except for Bobby Kennedy's abuse of power and his, you know, falling in love with a woman and telling her he was going to divorce his wife and all of his children and everything else like that. And that's exactly what led to her death. So these were tragic deaths that should have never happened.
So obviously it makes sense that had this Marilyn Monroe murder never taken place, then there would never have been a need to kill John F. Kennedy. But is there, and there are going to be a lot of people that ask this is, I guess, an obvious question, is there any connection between Robert Kennedy's assassination and the death of Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen? Or is that outside the scope of what you've looked at with respect to this book, Collateral Damage?
Well, one of the reasons I like to be on your program, Frank, and I appreciate it, because, you know, we're able to make people stop and think out there about these kinds of things. And you ask great questions, and that's a great question. I wish I could connect Bobby Kennedy's death to the other three. I think they are connected. Look at this logic. Okay, so Bobby Kennedy, you know, knows, and he told his son that he knew it was Marcello who killed JFK. And so now Bobby is out of power. He's no longer attorney general. He's running for president in 68. Well, if you're Carlos Marcello and anybody that had anything to do with the JFK assassination, you can't let him become president, because you know what's going to happen. He's going to come after you. So the motive is there. There's no question in my mind the motive is there. But I have not been able to connect either Sirhan Sirhan or the other gentleman that was with him that night in Los Angeles when RFK was killed. I can't connect them to Marcello or anybody in the mafia. I found at one point that Sirhan Sirhan had worked at the Hollywood racetrack. And so I tried to show that maybe Marcello and the mob were involved. But so far I can't. But logic tells me that there is a connection. And I would say again, as I do on many of these shows, if there are people out there who know anything about this, I get wonderful tips from people and follow them through. And a lot of that material's in the book. So if there's somebody out there that knows anything about that, I'd love to be able to connect it, because I think they are connected, those four deaths.
Well, it makes sense to me. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Talking with Mark Shaw about the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Dorothy Kilgallen. I have to take one more break. We'll continue with your calls next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, 800-848-WABC. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full.
The great Frank Sinatra singing My Way. By the way, if you're a Sinatra fan, you've got to listen to my friend Joe Piscopo every Sunday night from 6 to 9, doing Ramsey Mazda's Sunday with Sinatra. I was listening last night as Rachel and I were driving back from Long Island. Great show. A terrific, terrific show if you're a Sinatra fan. Sinatra, also a contemporary of Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedys. And a number of sources suggest that he had a little bit of animosity towards the Kennedys for their treatment of Marilyn Monroe. We've been talking with Mark Shaw. You've got to check out his new book if you're interested in any of this stuff. It's called Collateral Damage, and it explores the death of Marilyn Monroe. The full title is Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. We're going to take your calls for the remaining few minutes that we have, Mark, with us. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Diana is here in New York City. Diana, you're on with Mark Shaw.
Hi, Frank. Wonderful show, as always.
Thank you.
I'd be curious to know Mr. Shaw's thought about the following. That is that I heard Gianni Russo, your friend, interviewed corroborating everything that Mr. Shaw is saying, and further saying that Marilyn told Robert, whether or not it was true, that she told him that she was pregnant with his child. I'd be curious to know if Mr. Shaw has any information about that.
Mark, and I know you've been a guest on Johnny Russo's podcast as well, so whatever you have to say on that end, the floor is yours.
Well, Johnny Russo, I'm telling you, now there are people who are going to be skeptical of what he said in his book, Hollywood Godfather, but it's a terrific book. He's really filled in a lot of holes with regard to what happened, both to Marilyn, who he knew at an early age back in New York City there, and then his knowledge of what happened to her when she died, and on into the the connections with the Kennedys and so on and so forth that way. So I have a lot of respect for him. Yes, he has said that Marilyn supposedly could have been pregnant at the time. I have never been able to find credible evidence any place that that happened. Now, you know, that said, back in that day, it very well could have been secluded from anybody learning. I tried to check hospital records in the area and different things like that, but nothing has come to mind that that proves that it happened, and who it was with or whatever that way. So I've basically just gone with evidence. I don't like to speculate, so I've gone with the evidence that I could prove.
Thank you, Diana. Let me ask you this, Mark. All of this happened more than 60 years ago. Obviously, we have a lot of problems here in the year 2021, right? I mean, nationally, internationally, locally, there's a lot that we need to be concerned about fixing. Why is this still so important? Why should large police departments like the NYPD, like the LAPD, spend time investigating crimes that happened more than 60 years ago when almost everybody involved in these incidents has already passed on?
Well, it's all about history and correcting distortions of history, but it's also about justice. Neither of these women or JFK, in my opinion, got justice when they died. Their reputations were all tarnished and all of that. And again, I like to look at it like, okay, if these cases happened 2 days ago, they would be thoroughly investigated. They're victims of a crime. And so as victims of a crime, they are entitled to investigations of their death. And so it shouldn't make any difference that it was 60 years ago, especially with regard to both of these women and even JFK. With what happened to them, we need to clarify that, and those responsible need to be held accountable. This Ron Pataki, who I believe leaked Dorothy Kilgallen's evidence for the JFK assassination of the wrong people, he's still around, and I hope Philip Panzarella of the Cold Case Squad will investigate him. Bobby Kennedy, I know there's a lot of people out there that love the Kennedys, you know, and the Camelot and all this other kind of stuff. And in fact, I when I started this, I was a little reluctant to write it because, yeah, you know, he probably saved us from a nuclear war with Cuba, his brother Jack, you know, with civil rights and all of that kind of thing. But they were bad guys in a lot of ways. They were serial womanizers, just like their father. And then there's no question in my mind, and if anybody wants to debate me about this, I'd be glad to do it any place. Bobby Kennedy was responsible for Marilyn Monroe's death. You could prove it in a case of law with a first-year prosecutor based on all the evidence that I have. So he needs to be held accountable. And that's what I'm hoping I'm hoping we're going to find the truth about this. I was on a show the other night, and I was privileged that the host said, you know, Mark, hopefully what you have presented here will you know, cure a wound that we've had in this country, that the disinformation about JFK's death, about Dorothy's death, but especially about Marilyn's as well. And as a historian, that's my job.
Mark, do you believe, understanding that you've made the case that Robert Kennedy ordered the killing of Marilyn Monroe, do you believe that John F. Kennedy was also complicit or at least in the know about Robert Kennedy's decision to kill Marilyn Monroe?
Well, again, an excellent question. I can't speculate. I don't know, but it's hard to believe. You know, Jean Kennedy Smith, his JFK's sister, knew about it. Everybody knew about it. And yet, you know, they tried to button it up by, you know, closing out the case without any investigation and all that. But it's really hard to believe that, you know, that he wouldn't have known that something happened there. You know, I've sent both my books about Dorothy Kilgallen to Caroline Kennedy, and I'll send this one to her, saying to her, you know, at least read the book. And, you know, you could put a stop to all of these rumors about exactly what happened. And with this particular book, I'm telling you right now, Bobby Kennedy was responsible for your father's death. And if he would have been, you know, prosecuted for Marilyn's death, that would have never happened. So, you know, why don't you, she it's never responded to me or anybody else. She could come clean and you know, come out there and say, you know, based on all the evidence that's been presented now, this is what happened to my father. And boy, would that make such a difference. So I'm calling on her to do that. Why doesn't she do that and put to rest all of these rumors? If I'm wrong about everything I've said, then say that too. But just don't hide in the shadows about this. History needs you to come forward and you know, give us an indication of what you think happened in back in 1960.
You know, it's tough to argue with that. Mark, the hour has flown by. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. Oh, you got to come back. There's a whole lot of other information that's in this book, Collateral Damage. I want to encourage people to buy it. They can get it at markshawbooks.com. They can get it at Amazon. Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. Mark, congratulations on an incredible effort on this book. And let's hope you're able to get some justice for some people that have been without it for far too long.
Frank, you're a good man. Thanks so much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Mark Shaw, check him out again, markshawbooks.com. Pretty groundbreaking. Next hour, we'll have an opportunity to take more of your calls, 1-800-848-9222. Any subject is fair game. We'll get into the mayor's race as well. In the 4 o'clock hour, yesterday was the 77th anniversary of D-Day, one of the most remarkable military adventures in history. We're going to get into that and a whole lot more. Until next hour, in the words of the great Barry Farber, keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to be joined by historian David Piatruzza. We'll talk about the 77th anniversary of D-Day that took place yesterday, but really yesterday was only 2 hours ago, so I think we can still look at D-Day. I'll tell you, D-Day is one of the most incredible achievements, not only in American history, but in human history. Forgetting about the military logistics, the socioeconomic and political implications to the successful Allied invasion of Europe on D-Day is something that literally changed the course of world history. We're going to get into that in a big way with David Piatruzza, because even though it's 77 years later, I don't think we could pay enough attention to it. You know, I was every day we lose more and more World War II veterans. I made this point to John Catsimatidis yesterday on the Cats Roundtable. Every day we lose more and more World War II veterans. And pretty soon, very soon actually, we will have zero living World War II veterans. And so I think it's important, while there are at least still some World War II veterans around, to pay pretty close attention to World War II history and see what we can learn from it in terms of where we are in the world today and where we are in this country today. All right. The mayor's race, I want to give a quick update on that. I'll invite you to comment on it. 1-800-848-WABC. An absolute game changer took place on Saturday. And I don't want to pat myself on the back here, because I think any analyst worth his salt could have seen this was happening. But I predicted what was going to happen on Saturday a month ago. And I reiterated that prediction when I was on with Rita Cosby. I think it was on Wednesday night, either Wednesday or Thursday night. And that was the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsement. Now, AOC, yeah, you know me. AOC is New York City's leading progressive. And she has an enormous amount of clout. You may not like her politics. I don't particularly agree with many of the things she says. But she's incredibly influential with New York City's left wing. And when we are going into a Democratic primary for mayor, which could be determinative of the overall election, this endorsement is potentially a game changer. So this weekend, AOC came out with her endorsement in the race for mayor and said she's picking.
But once again, today is a crucial moment. We cannot afford to sit on the sidelines. We can't afford to not engage because of what could have been, right? We engage in the world that we have, and we do everything we can to make that world better. We have a choice to make New York City better. We have a choice that is clearly better than privatizing our school system and allowing housing to be built only for the wealthiest people. We have an option of a candidate who can center people, racial justice, economic justice, and climate justice, that didn't just come up to run for mayor, but has experience and has a lifetime of dedication to this. And that candidate is Maya Wiley.
So it is interesting to me that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pronounces her name Maya Wiley. I've heard it pronounced both ways, both Maya Wiley and Maya Wiley. I always thought it was Maya Wiley, but I'll go along with the AOC pronunciation and assume it's Maya Wiley. Let me tell you something. Mark my words here. Early voting is starting in days. The primary, the final day of the primary, is in a couple of weeks. People have their absentee ballots already. This endorsement, coupled with the boatload of money that George Soros is spending on behalf of Maya Wiley, this endorsement is potentially, it's not potentially, this endorsement is game-changing. This endorsement, in one foul swoop, has turned this mayor's race from a three-way race into a four-way race. It was a race between Adams, Yang, and Garcia. That is no longer the case. This is now a race between Adams, Yang, Garcia, and Wiley. Now, this is why. Now, Wiley would be an incredibly dangerous candidate. Out of the four people I just mentioned, she's the only one openly calling for defunding another $1 billion from the police. She is smart. She is incredibly radical. She is incredibly left-wing. And she has repeatedly demonstrated an antipathy towards the New York City Police Department, which is nothing short of dangerous, while we're seeing crime spike all over the city. And if she is the Democratic nominee, she has an excellent chance of winning. Now, this is why everybody should be really grateful that we have ranked choice voting in this city. Because if we didn't have ranked choice voting, Wiley could slip in with just 40% of the vote, just the hardcore progressives. Now, the three moderate candidates running, I guess four if you include McGuire, but McGuire's not much of a factor. The three or four moderate candidates running, you can rank Adams first, then Yang second, then Garcia third. You can rank McGuire first, then Yang second, then Garcia third, Adams fourth. So this way, you don't have to worry about Wiley slipping in with a plurality. Ranked choice voting is the only thing that may save this city from Mayor Maya Wiley. Okay? mark my words. Curtis Lee was the candidate that I'm supporting. He's the Republican. He's the presumptive Republican nominee. He has a primary, but he doesn't have serious opposition. Curtis Lee, the best candidate I think that he could hope to face now that Stringer is out of the main competition. We'll get into him in a second. The best candidate that he could hope to face is Maya Wiley. Because while Curtis Lee is taking an unabashedly tough on crime approach, Maya Wiley is taking a far left wing anti-cop approach, which I don't think even a lot of Democrats will embrace. Eric Adams, he's got the law enforcement card, too, because of his policing background. Andrew Yang has the same non-politician appeal that Curtis Sliwa has, the same sort of outsider appeal. Andrew Yang's also a bit of a showman, which Curtis is. Catherine Garcia, she's not going to frighten anybody, right? So nobody will be frightened at the prospect of a mayor, Catherine Garcia. So it's difficult to see how Curtis could cobble together a coalition against a Garcia. However, Maya Wiley, I think you would see not only Democrat, not only Republicans and independents in this city, but real estate interests and moderate Democrats of all stripes run to give money to Curtis and to vote for Curtis. So if you're a Democrat, look, I don't know who to root for. I said this on the Cats Roundtable yesterday. I don't know who to root for. Do you root for the candidate that is best for Curtis to face off against, which would probably be Maya Wiley? Or do you root for the candidate that's the least dangerous, in which case it's not Maya Wiley? So I don't know. I'm not a Democrat, so I don't know how I would vote if I were. But I would probably not risk the fact that Maya Wiley could get elected here. I would still probably not rank her at all. I would rank Garcia. I would rank Yang. I would rank Adams. I would rank McGuire. And then that leaves the gentleman, and I'll take your calls on this, or if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. There is now a second Scott Stringer accuser. I have to tell you, again, I don't like to question anybody that's making a sexual misconduct allegation against anyone else. However, in my judgment, this second accusation is even weaker than the first. And I give this next to no credibility whatsoever. So a second woman has now accused New York. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm not a Scott Stringer fan. I would never vote for him. I think he's been a terrible controller by and large, especially his second term. That being said, I think he is being totally railroaded here, totally hung out to dry. And I find both of the accusations against him very questionable. That being said, Teresa Logan is the second accuser, and I give her credit for putting her name out there. Teresa Logan told the New York Times that Stringer groped and kissed her without consent when she worked as a waitress at a bar he co-founded and helped run nearly 30 years ago. So this woman was groped in a bar 30 years ago, and now's the time that she's come forward to lay out everything about that claim. She didn't come forward when Scott Stringer was elected to the state assembly. She didn't come forward when Scott Stringer ran for public advocate. She didn't come forward when Scott Stringer ran for Manhattan Borough president. She didn't come forward when he was Manhattan Borough president. She didn't come forward when he was running against a guy that's pretty sexually creepy in his own right, Elliot Spitzer. She didn't come forward when he was elected controller. Now that Scott Stringer is 15 days before the biggest election of his life, now is when she's choosing to come forward about these allegations 30 years ago. Let me tell you what she said. And again, you know, I wish I would have gotten the audio of Lauren Conlon for a couple of weeks ago talking about how she's been groped and how common groping actually is. Now, it doesn't make it right. I would never do that to somebody. But this does happen. And 30 years ago, in a bar-like atmosphere, this did happen pretty frequently. And I just find it pretty suspicious that this woman is choosing to come out now and tell her story. So she said this first incident took place while she was carrying trays past Stringer on a stairwell at a bar that he was a partner in, the Uptown Local, in spring of 1992. Spring of 1992, 30 years ago. So she was 18 at the time. He was 32. And this is what she told the New York Times. He just like totally pats me on the butt and like squeezes it. I had no way of reacting. My hands weren't free to even protect myself. So then Logan said, quote, it freaked me out, but that she sort of glossed it over by telling herself this dude's a creep. So are a lot of guys at bars probably. Now, I think that's true that a lot of guys in bars are creeps and will pat a waitress on the butt. Now, another time, Logan said she agreed to accompany Stringer to another bar before he surprisingly hailed a cab for the trip. Now, here's where what I wonder. If she already knows this guy is a creep, that he's patting her on the butt in an unwanted grope, why would she agree to go anywhere with him in a social setting? Why? Why would she agree to ever go to a bar with him? But she did. So again, I find that kind of questionable as well. So this is what she said to the New York Times. I just have a memory of him in the car, putting his hand on my inner thigh. At one point, Logan said Stringer kissed her. I was like, no, no, no. And then when I was so strong about the no in the situation, it stopped. So do you understand what she's saying is sexual assault, essentially? She's saying that he tried to kiss her. She said no, and he stopped. Now, that's 30 years ago. I can tell you, if that is now the barometer for a sexual harassment or sexual assault allegation, then I am in a lot of trouble. So Logan, who's now 47, works in the fashion industry, said Stringer kind of laughed it off like, oh, I'm drunk. I'm sorry. Well, I know a lot of other drunk guys and drunk women, by the way, who've tried to kiss someone who didn't want to kiss them. And when they said no, these guys stopped. And that's all Stringer did in this other incident. I think this is such a weak allegation. And for the New York Times and the New York Post and the New York Daily News to publish and spend so much time and space on this allegation, it's clear that they are trying to collectively drive the nail into the Stringer campaign coffin. I don't know why. I don't know what the motivation is here, but it's very suspicious. Now, Stringer himself, again, I don't have a lot of sympathy for him because when Brett Kavanaugh was accused with pretty flimsy evidence, he had no problem jumping on that bandwagon. When Andrew Cuomo was accused with pretty flimsy evidence, Scott Stringer came out and said, yes, he should resign, he should resign. So now the same standards that Scott Stringer has applied to other people that have been accused are now coming home to roost against him. I've been very consistent that I think if you're assaulted or groped or harassed, you should report that sometime before 30 years. Before 30 years go by, you should say something. And I think it's ridiculous that this is all coming out now. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. For my money, this Maya Wiley endorsement by AOC is a game changer. Additionally, I think that the media coverage of this second Stringer accusation is going to contribute to his campaign faltering, and I think he's pretty much done politically. I don't think it's right that he's done, but I think he's done. Your calls next. We have 9 open lines, 800-848-WABC. We'll talk about D-Day a little bit later. I do want to tell you today, right before, first thing I did when I woke up, even before I did, well, yesterday technically, right before we taped the Cats Roundtable, I took 2 big glasses of Life Change tea. I got to tell you, on a day when it's 90 degrees out, There is nothing more refreshing than an ice cold glass of tea, but especially Life Change tea. You know why? Because it's not sweet. Sometimes you can't really guzzle iced tea because it's so sweet you almost want to vomit because of the sweetness. Life Change tea is not sweet. It's dry. It's delicious. But when it's nice and ice cold like that, oh, nothing better in terms of a summertime treat. Now, when you add to that the fact that it gives you a ton of energy without caffeine, and you add to that what it does in terms of aiding your digestion, I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't be getting Life Change tea right now. So how do you get it? You go to the website, getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you order it and you use the promo code Frank, that's getthetea.com, promo code Frank, you can save some money on shipping. In fact, it'll be free shipping anywhere in America, in the continental United States, I should say. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. Try it. You'll like it. It's the tea that makes you go, and I think you'll find it does indeed. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank.
It's the Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
There is nothing that is wrong wanting you to stay here. Got somewhere to go, but won't you make yourself at home and stay with me? And don't you ever leave.
Lay down, Sally, and rest you in my arms.
Don't you think you want someone to talk to?
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. It's Eric Clapton singing Lay Down Sally. Taking your calls about the mayor's race, the AOC endorsement of Maya Wiley is a game changer. It has turned this race in one moment from a three-way race into a four-way race. And now Maya Wiley has a fighting chance of being the Democratic nominee, which means she has a very good chance of being the next mayor of New York City, which is pretty frightening. Also talking about this latest Scott Stringer accusation that came out on Friday. 800-848-9222. Then we'll move on to some other things. Let me say hello to Kelly in Bayport. Kelly, it's been a while since I've heard from you.
I'm going to say, I'm never up this late. I used to listen to you at, what was it, 10 in the morning?
That's right, 10 a.m., 10 a.m.
Yeah,
that's right.
I'm not usually up this late. I'm a good girl. anyway, I'm doing some funding. Anyway, I wanted to tell you, yes, I'm with you. I don't care for Scott Stringer. I'm definitely with Curtis. But I'm a 54-year-old woman, so I think about 30 years ago. That's in your early 20s. And, you know, if I called up the police, they have a statute of limitations and said, all these people groped me, or I was almost raped at like a holiday party. I'm not saying it's right.
I'm sorry to hear that.
You know?
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying that it was a chef, and, you know, the owners were like these, you know, they were the very despotic kind of individuals. It wasn't these corporations where they have HR and all that. And, you know, you just kind of live with it. I'm not saying it's okay. I think it's good that today's women feel more powerful than women of my day.
Sure.
However, the statute of limitations, whatever it is for a crime, it shouldn't be much longer for something, an accusation, because times change. And I also look at, like, all these millennials who think everything is racism, not all of them, but, you know, are they looking at their parents as racist? Because if you're going to be consistent, you have to say, hey, gee, your parents are 60, they didn't do this about this, and they didn't do anything about gun control, and they didn't do anything about this, and you really should despise them, too. Although I don't want them to, because that's like the socialist thing. That's about all I have to say.
Well, yeah,
but
no,
I'm enjoying
I do.
Your show tonight.
Well, thanks, Kelly. I appreciate you staying up late. What made you stay up so late tonight, for instance?
I actually got home. I've been doing some door dashing on the part time on the side. I got
very nice.
At 11, and then I just decided instead of wasting my day tomorrow cleaning and doing everything, I'll just do it tonight.
Great. Well, we like it when you.
I had two drinks. Is that okay? I had two drinks.
It's fine with me. What were you drinking?
Just a little wine.
Wine, okay. Red or white?
And I used to call you completely sober. Red.
Red. Well, yeah. Red. No. That you
healthy.
You were the one sober caller I had. That's for sure, Kelly. All right, Kelly. Thank you. Appreciate you calling.
Thank you.
I do agree with you. I mean, what Kelly says there is right on the money, right? So there's a statute of limitations for crimes. Now, the reason there's a statute of limitations for crimes, except murder, is because, you know, if you're accused of a crime, You want to be able to gather evidence to prove your innocence. You want to be able to have something resembling a fresh recollection. Now, Scott Stringer, in his statement, when asked about this, he said, I don't remember this woman, but if I ever did anything inappropriate, I apologize. I believe him that he didn't remember this woman. But Scott Stringer hanging out with in bars 30 years ago, probably the guy was drunk all the time. I guarantee you he was, you know, being flirtatious with a number of different women, trying to kiss a lot, drunkenly kiss a lot of different women. And not surprisingly, Scott Stringer's not exactly a dreamboat. I'm betting this is not the first woman that ever said no to him. And so far, there's no allegation at all that he kept pursuing a woman after she said no. But I agree. You know what? If you want to make an issue of something that somebody does to you, do it within a reasonable amount of time. I don't know what a reasonable amount of time is. I do know 30 years is not a reasonable amount of time. 800-848-WABC. Neil is on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Frank. Yesterday we had our own D-Day in New York City. The police were incapable of closing down Washington Square Park, a small little park. They fought with the protesters the day before. The curfew was still in effect. They didn't do anything today. They're riding around with ATVs. People are still there. Nobody cares. The law doesn't mean anything. Curfews don't mean anything. And then we got this bonehead mayor who actually has the nerve to go visit the family of a poor little 10-year-old boy. When I saw that little boy on TV, I started to cry after being shot in the stomach and killed. He's the guy that defunded the police. He signed every bill to hurt the police, and he goes to visit the family. What a set of cojones he has. I was just sick. And then when you come to the mayor's race, Frank, finally, all these guys. I mean, it's incredible. They want more housing, take care of the police. I mean, this is the most progressive mayor we ever had. They make him out to be like a Donald Trump, a conservative.
You're right.
He's a conservative compared to these lunatics.
Oh, well, you're right. You're right. No, I mean, if Mayor Wiley ever ends up in the mayor's office, which I hope she doesn't, believe me, you're going to have people wishing for Bill de Blasio's return, which seems hard to believe now. Neil, I echo your sentiments on the 10-year-old boy killed, and thank you for calling. Thank you for mentioning that. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848. WABC, that's 1-800-848-9222. Yesterday, I was on Long Island, and my brother-in-law is a physical therapist, and he's got a master's degree in physical therapy. He's a personal trainer, but he's an expert in anything related to the human body. And he had this thing that I don't even know what you call it. I called it a Theragun or something. And wherever you had pain or inflammation, he would use this thing on it. And it was pretty effective. But it took a fair amount of time to get rid of that pain wherever you have it. Mine was my shoulder, a lingering can jam injury. It took a fair amount of time being worked with this Theragun before you had pain relief. Now, what if you could get that same relief in just 3 5-minute sessions? Well, thankfully now you can. You've got back pain. You've got knee pain. You've got shoulder tendonitis. You've got plantar fasciitis. You've got tennis elbow. Whatever your issue with chronic pain or inflammation is, the good folks at Trinity Rehab can help because they've got something called the EPAT machine. This is an FDA-approved non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. They are all over New Jersey. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, Woodbridge. Jen Kearns was listening to me on Friday talk about the EPAT machine and Trinity Rehab. She says, I want to go there. Are they in New York? Unfortunately, it does not appear they're in New York, but you can go right over the bridge to New Jersey. I mean, and we have so many listeners in New Jersey. I am guessing there's a lot of you that do deal with chronic pain on a regular basis. So my question for you is, why deal with chronic pain when you don't have to? Call Trinity Rehab today at 800-518-0977. That's Trinity Rehab, 800-518-0977, or go to trinity-rehab.com. That's trinity-rehab.com. No prescription required. before you consider surgery, before you consider drugs, call Trinity Rehab. 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977.
It's Ramsey Mazda's Sundays with Sinatra. This Sunday night starting at 6.
Strangers in the night.
With your host, the Vice Chairman of the Board, Joe Piscopo.
It's the good life. And the way you look tonight.
It's Ramsey Mazda's Sundays with Sinatra. This Sunday night starting at 6.
With me, Joe Piscopo.
On
Music Radio. WABC. Frank Morano. 77. WABC.
From the time that I heard my first fairy tale, I dreamed of how love would be. I searched every new face to find my prince, wondering when he'd come to me. The heartbreaks and detours broke me down. I'd almost given up. Then I found you.
I found you. A terrific song by one of our most dedicated listeners, Man Darava. I'm not sure where you can get this song, but she sent this to me when we were having difficulty with music licensing and stuff. And it is pretty catchy, I must say. Very well done. She's been on the show as a numerologist before.
SoundCloud.com/I_M_Mandarava, MANDARAVA.
All right, nobody is going to write that.
I'm just trying to help out.
You know what, Gabby, if you send Gabby the link, and she'll post it in our Facebook group. Go online to Morano Radio Fans and Haters on Facebook, and if you like that song, we'll tell you where you can get all of Miss M's songs. That's Facebook. Just search Morano Radio Fans and Haters, MORANO Radio Fans and Haters. How are you doing, Mr. Christian?
I'm doing very well, Frank. How was your weekend?
Mine was not bad. What did you do?
A lot of beach.
Really?
A lot of beach, yeah.
I was picturing you so busy on the weekend covering hockey games and catching up on sleep, and you went to the beach.
I snuck in a beach day before the hockey game. I was actually supposed to go golfing on Saturday, but I kind of punted, and my friend and I decided to just go to the beach.
Yeah, well, I didn't think they had punting in golf.
We changed the plan.
You changed
That's
the
what
rules,
I meant by
I
that. Yes.
We'll get into golf maybe tomorrow. I have some thoughts on golf now that a lot of people are doing more and more golf. And good for you. Gabby, what did you do with yourself this weekend?
I actually had such a great weekend. I was in the sun all weekend. I also went to the beach. I was at the beach Saturday and this morning.
Oh, so you both did beach stuff.
Yes.
Wow.
Very nice. And one of my friends graduated from college early because we're all juniors now, but he graduated a year earlier.
Oh, congratulations to him.
Yes.
What's he going to do with himself now?
He actually is an architect.
Oh.
So he already has a job in the city and stuff, and he's all set.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. All right. Now, I, on Sunday, drove out. I missed that yacht party that everybody was talking about, which our ownership and our president, Chad Lopez, was kind enough to invite me to. But perfect day for a yacht. Maybe it was a little hot, but I don't think it was hot on the water. I know Juliet was there. Dominic Carter was talking about it on his show. I know Lydia was there. I think Joe Piscopo was there. Even Bernie McGurk, who never goes to these things, I think he might have been there as well. I didn't get to hear much of Dominic's discussion about it, but what did you hear, if anything, about this yacht trip? Anything?
I only saw the photos that Juliet put on social media.
Yeah, so I didn't see them. How did it look?
It looked like a lot of fun. Mm. I mean, it seemed like anybody. Dave was there, our program director, and there's a very great nice shot of Juliet and her husband with Rudy Giuliani. So it seemed like a lot of fun out there.
Mayor Giuliani was there as well.
Yeah.
Very nice. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't be there. But Sunday we had plans out on Eastern Long Island to celebrate two of my brothers-in-law's birthday and one and my wife's brother-in-law, who is not technically my brother-in-law, but we don't have a word for that relationship in English. So it was sort of a joint birthday party. So we drove all the way out to Long Island, ton of traffic, about 2 hours, and drove all the way back. I was in, I was largely asleep almost the entire trip out there because my wife drove, and almost the entire trip back. In fact, I was sleeping so much on the way out there. My wife was asking, well, why are you so tired? Or did you not get a lot of sleep? No, I didn't because I was up early to do the Cats round table, and I was up kind of late last night. But I did manage to be awake most of the 11 a.m. hour as we were driving out there. We left our home around 10 o'clock and then head out to Long Island. And she works for Newsday, so she had to photograph some people out there for this column that she writes for called Faces of Long Island, which she does a great job with. And she had to photograph three different people. But as we were driving out there, I flipped between two 11 a.m. radio stations. I listened to my friend AC Mike, who does a radio show in Atlantic City. And then I listened to John McDonough on WBAI, who does a terrific radio show. And now, obviously, Judge Jeanine Pirro, she does a great radio show. She's the one of the highest-rated shows we have as a station, so she does great. It's just I need a little bit of a break from wall-to-wall politics on the weekend. So I try to go and explore other stations, and I really like AC Mike, and I really like John McDonough. So lo and behold, I'm listening to John McDonough around 20 after 11 yesterday, and you might remember John McDonough was on this show with Jen Kearns on Friday, and all of a sudden, John McDonough comes out and says,
"Oh yes, Finnegan's Wake. And you listen to WBAI with Malachy McCourt and John McDonough. I would just like to do a shout out to Frank Morano over at WABC Radio. He has a show on five nights a week from 1 to 5 in the morning called The Other Side of Midnight. And he had me on there during the week to debate somebody who does right-wing radio. And what I was amazed about the call is there's a huge crossover between WABC and WBAI, between Gary from Staten Island, Russell from White Plains, and Tom from the Bronx. And if you get a chance and you're going through the dial and you're listening, Frank Morano is very good, and he has a ton of different type of guests."
That was very nice, that little endorsement impromptu, especially when I just happened to be listening. And then I was listening to AC Mike on his show, who's also been on the show from time to time. And he mentions how his show is expanding to other days of the week. And I texted him congratulations. He said, oh, you know, you got to call in. So he gave me a whole big shout out as well. And it goes to show, he was interviewing at the time I called in the owner of the Boogie Nights nightclub in Atlantic City, which is at the Tropicana. And it turns out the owner of the Boogie Nights nightclub, David, is a – I think his name's David Pena. I could be wrong about his last name. His first name's definitely David. Is a huge fan of the show, and he really wants us to do – once Boogie Nights reopens, which is going to be soon, he really wants us to do this show from there. So we're going to have to do that. Maybe the weekend that they reopen, we'll try and do the show from there. At the Trop at Boogie Nights.
You don't have to sell Gabby and I
good.
At all.
Right,
we're already in.
We'll have to definitely do that. So that was a lot of fun. I can't wait to hear from Juliet when she gets here about how that yacht event was. It looked like a lot of fun. I'm sorry to have missed that. But again, I had this pre-commitment on Long Island first, but we'll find out from Juliet how it did went. There were a lot of interesting people there from what it looked like. All right, 800-848-9222. Your calls are welcome on any subject. We're going to get into D-Day in a little bit. We're going to talk commendations. So Friday is the annual Talkers Magazine Conference. Now, if you're not familiar with Talkers Magazine, that is the leading trade publication for talk radio. I've been reading Talkers Magazine since I was 10, and maybe a little more recently than that, but certainly for many, many years, I've been reading Talkers Magazine. And it's so great because those of us that are talk radio addicts and those of us that work in talk radio, there are so few places that you can actually read about what's going on in our industry. So those of you that want – if you want to hear – it's not even a magazine anymore. Now it's just an email newsletter and a website. I think it's talkers.com. So if you want to hear about what's happening in talk radio, this is the really the only spot to do it. other than when I talk about the talk radio industry in general. And the publisher of Talkers, Michael Harrison, he's been a guest on this show. I was on his podcast last weekend. He's been such a big proponent of my career and such a big supporter. Now, I have been to the Talkers Conference before, but I generally don't go to it. And I always have a reason, really, and I was trying to think of this, because every year they have all these great panels of talk show hosts and talk show consultants and talk show programmers, and I always end up trying to watch the videos of these panels afterwards. And I was trying to figure out, why don't I ever end up just going? And ultimately, it's because I want to act like a big shot. It's because I want to act like I'm too cool to go to these other things that all these other talk show hosts going to. Yeah, I don't need to do that. Let the talk show hosts from Indiana and California and Michigan, let them go to all these conferences. I don't need that. But then I realized that I'm just kind of, first of all, I'm not too cool for this. Second of all, I'm just really cutting off my nose to spite my face, because I am interested in the content. So then I would a lot of the time try to get a free ticket to this, because it is pretty expensive to go to this. I would try to get a free ticket to this from somebody. Usually I would have a boss or a coworker that was on one of the panels or multiple panels. And I would say to them, hey, do you think you can get me into Talkers? Because out of principle, I felt like I shouldn't have to pay $350 or whatever the registration fee was to go to this. And the answer is always the same, is no. They can't get me in for free, but they could probably get me in just on their panel discussion. So, and then the last couple of years, it's been out on Long Island, which is not nearly as convenient as when it's in Midtown, which is where it used to be. So this year I said, screw it. Michael Harrison has been a good friend to me. He's given me a lot of great publicity in Talkers.com. At the Barry Farber Memorial, he gave me this big buildup. Talk about what a great talent I am, what a great talk show host I am. And then he does that all the time. So I said, look, one is I'm so eager to see all these people again. I haven't seen them in a year and a half to 2 years, all these other talk show hosts from around the country. Two, I have a lot of colleagues that are on panels. Juliet is on a panel. Sid Rosenberg's on a panel. Dave Labrosi's on a panel. He's our program director. Brian Kilmeade is speaking. Bill O'Reilly is speaking. And then I have a lot of friends that are going to be there. Harry Hurley's going to be there. An old friend of mine, Frank McKay, who I recently reconciled with after not speaking to for 10 years. He's going to be there. He's speaking. So I said, look, what am I doing? I clearly want to go. I don't have anything else scheduled that day. It's a good way for me to go to something that I'm interested in. It's a good way for me to support my coworkers. It's a good way for me to support Michael Harrison and Talkers. And look, I am a talk show industry junkie, so I really should be there. And this is an event that's tailor-made for me. So I'm kind of done pretending that I'm too cool to go to this event. And from now on, I'm just going to go. So I'm going to bite the bullet and go. It's a whole day's worth of things from about 8 a.m. to 6:15 p.m. Now, I'm not going to go to the whole day's events, but I'll drive out there probably around 8-ish, and I'll pick and choose. Maybe go to this panel, go to that panel. Now, because of our hours, I am going to have to try and sleep at some point. So I was thinking about getting a hotel room that day that I could sneak away to, you know, kind of take a nap now and again. And then what I was thinking is they have this reception that goes from at Hofstra University, that goes from 5:15 to 6:15. But they also have this hotel that they're encouraging the attendees to stay at that is right there in Uniondale. So I was thinking maybe Juliet and I, since she's going to be on the last panel before the reception, maybe Juliet and I can throw a post-reception reception where I invite all these people, all these colleagues of ours, and these talk show hosts that I know from around the country to join us for a reception at the hotel bar after the Talkers reception. And this way, people that aren't going to Talkers, like Gabby and Christian, for instance, and whomever else happens to be out there, maybe they don't want to pay the registration fee to go to the conference, but maybe they would want to join us for the post-reception reception. And we'll make it a cash bar. Whoever wants to pay. Now, Christian, you went to Hofstra, so you're familiar with this area and this particular hotel. What's the story with the bar there? How big is it? Can we get 20, 30 people?
I think so. There? It's actually – so it used to be kind of this divey, like, sports bar for a long time.
Right, well, I like called, that. That's kind of my scene.
It used to be called Champions, and it was a big thing after Islander games or before Islander games, and now it's a little bit more they've kind of classed up the joint, and the hotel is a little bit nicer. They've redone a little bit of it, and they redid the bar entirely. But it's still a pretty sizable bar, and you could fit a good group of people there for sure.
Do you think – now, everybody's going to pay for their own drinks, I guess, but do you think I have to call the hotel and let them know that I'm thinking of having everybody there at this bar in advance?
I don't think so. I would just call them and just make sure that the hotel bar is operating.
And we'll be open.
It's normal hours.
Okay.
Because
well,
I think that's the
that's
biggest thing.
And so you're going to come to that, right?
The 100%.
Reception.
Yeah.
Gabby, you're in now that you're 21 years old for the post-reception
reception? Absolutely.
Good. We'll have fun. Juliet will be there. She's under the illusion that she's not going to be drinking until she goes to Italy. I don't know what planet she's on where she thinks that's the case.
I saw a couple pictures with her with a beverage in her hand.
Well, she told us Friday that she was going to have some champagne on the yacht ride. So
can't go on a yacht and not have
exactly.
A drink.
And you can't really pick and choose. Either you're drinking or you're not, right? You don't have to overdo it, but – you know, it is what it is. So that'll be fun. That'll be next Friday. I'm really looking forward to going, actually. I've found myself really excited about it. All right. You know who was there? I ran into one of our big sales guys. I'm not sure if his title is general sales manager or whatever. But Glenn, I ran into him on Friday when I was grabbing lunch. And he said, you know, one of the people that's going to be on the yacht is Gary and Julie. From the law firm of Angiuli and Gentili. So I would have liked to have hung out with Gary Angiuli and his wife for a bit because they're really fun people. And more so than being fun people, Gary is a terrific, terrific lawyer. And what he has been able to build at the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentili is absolutely phenomenal. So if you have a workplace injury or an occupational disease that has turned your life upside down, like carpal tunnel or something like that, you need to contact the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentili. They'll walk you through the workers' compensation process. They'll help you get your medical bills paid. They have been helping take the fear out of the workers' compensation process for over 35 years. And they'll listen to your concerns. They'll explain how all this works to get you the medical treatment and the workers' compensation payments that you're entitled to. The Staten Island lawyers at Angiuli and Gentili have handled thousands of hearings and will help you walk with confidence. Call Angiuli and Gentili right now. We'll call them today. You don't have to call them at 3 o'clock in the morning. But write this number down and call them today. 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-COMP. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. That is 888-234-COMP, 888-234-2667.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Never change things that I feel. If I could.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Thank you for listening. You know what we're doing this week? We're trying something a little different, as you heard with the interview that I did with Mark Shaw earlier, and you'll hear with David Pietruzza. All week long, every day, we are doing nothing but long-form interviews, where we're going to have people on the show, guests on the show for an hour, sometimes maybe more than an hour, and we'll take your calls and really delve in-depth into some of these issues. That's what we're going to do this week. It's going to be fun. And then next week, we're going to try something completely different. No guests the entire week. So we're going to go from long-form interviews with guests to next week, no guests whatsoever. So to me, this is what talk radio is all about. It's all about experimenting and kind of doing our thing. Hey, I do want to encourage you to join. You know, a lot of people listen to the show on podcast. And if you're somebody that doesn't get to hear the show in its entirety, you should really subscribe to the podcast. You can just go to fmwabc.com. That's fmwabc.com. M as in Frank Moreno, WABC.com, or just search The Other Side of Midnight or wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, wherever, and just click the subscribe button. We'd also appreciate it if you left a nice little review, a nice little comment explaining why you like the show. Now, if you listen to the show, whether you like it or not, you're going to want to join the Morano Radio Fans and Haters Facebook page. That's on Facebook group, rather. Now, this is a discussion group. Just go on Facebook and type M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. And it's a discussion group for discussing what goes on this show. Oh, I like this interview. I don't like that interview. I like that guest. I don't like this guest. So there's all sorts of stuff going on in that discussion group. It's pretty entertaining. Even the people that are really mean are fairly entertaining. Even the people that are really nice bring up some good points. I would only ask if you join that discussion group, try to be nice to everybody. Don't, or except me. You don't have to be nice to me, but be nice to everybody else that's commenting on that. And you could see not only the video that Gabby did Friday reviewing our latest pizza establishment, but you can also see a video interview that I did with Zen Sams on her podcast as well. So you could see the video of that. I don't think I look particularly good there. I kind of woke up in the middle of the day to do that interview, and it sort of looks like it. But you could go there for yourself and judge for yourself. But we are trying – you know, there was this big boxing match last night between Floyd Mayweather Jr. and Logan Paul. And if we have time later, I'd love to talk about that. But it's an exhibition match. All the big talked about boxing matches these days are all not really boxing matches. They're not sanctioned by anybody. They're just exhibition matches. They're shows, basically. They're publicity stunts. And so Floyd Mayweather Jr., who's a real boxer and probably one of the best boxers of all time, he fought this guy, Logan Paul. Now, who is Logan Paul? All Logan Paul is this YouTuber. He's a guy that makes videos on YouTube, and apparently he's become this huge media personality. And evidently, if you want to be anything these days, on the radio, on TV, in politics, whatever, all you have to do is have a large social media following. Jennifer Grodd, who books guests for this show, sometimes she shares with me emails of folks that that get back to her. And a lot of guests, including a lot of guests that I didn't think were that big of a deal. A lot of guests write back to her, oh, yes, send us all of Frank's social media statistics. They don't even want to come on this show unless we have a large social media following. So the best thing we can all do is make me into one of America's leading social media influencers. So I would ask that you follow me on all three major forms of social media on Twitter, at Frank Morano. It's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. On Facebook, facebook.com/MoranoFan. And on Instagram, at Morano Vision. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Vision. And we can have me be the next Logan Paul. How great would it be to see me fight Floyd Mayweather Jr.? All I need is, I think, another couple of million Twitter followers. So you can be part of the Moranoholics, the Morano Army, by following me on Twitter, at Frank Morano. Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. And I do tweet a lot of interesting things. So you're not going to want to miss it, believe me. All right. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Coming up next hour, we'll do commendations. And then a little bit later, we'll talk about D-Day. Until next hour, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. 1-800-848-WABC is our telephone number if you would like to be heard. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Meantime, this is a portion of the week that I know so many of you look forward to. This is a time where there's a little recognition paid to those that deserve a little bit of recognition. This is the time for often imitated, never quite duplicated.
The Other Side of Midnight presents Commendations.
That's right. I must give a commendation to the following entities. First and foremost, I want to give a commendation to the Passamaquoddy tribe. This is an American Indian tribe in Maine that has bought back an island that was taken from them 160 years ago. So they bought for $449,000 an island, the 140 acres. It's called White's Island. 143 acres of forests with sweeping views of the rugged shoreline of Big Lake in Maine. So its original name was Pine Island. And this small tribe of 3,700 Passamaquoddy, who had lived there for at least 10,000 years, had this island taken away from them in 1820. And even though there were still some Passamaquoddy living there, they had no ownership of the island. So now they have taken this back. But the historic preservation officer for the tribe, Donald Sakdama, said, "Our concept of land ownership is that nobody owns land. Instead, we have a sacred duty to protect it. This is like finding a lost relative." I think that is very nice. And I think it's a wonderful thing that this tribe was able to get their land back. Now, this is a dual commendation, but first I got to tell you a story. So we arrived at my mother-in-law's in Mastic, Long Island yesterday at 2 p.m. Now, everyone was supposed to be getting there at 1, but we told everyone we were going to get there at 2 because my wife had to photograph a couple of people for her Faces of Long Island column. And so we get there at 2, and we see that my sister-in-law, Deborah, who was traveling without her husband but with her two stepdaughters, was not yet there. So I get in there, and I learn that Deborah is stranded on the side of the road on the Long Island Expressway somewhere in Nassau County because she's got a flat tire. Now, this would not be an issue for me because I get so many flat tires, I can now change flat tires with my eyes closed. But she is in a different position, and she's there with these two little girls, and you know, she's worried, and she's stranded in the middle of nowhere. She lives all the way out in Lakewood, New Jersey, and she's traveling all the way to Eastern Long Island, and she's stranded on the side of the road with respect to, you know, in Nassau County. Not anywhere near where she lives or where she's going. So what would you do? Well, of course, you'd call AAA. She's not a member of AAA. How anyone is not a member of AAA, I cannot understand. Because whatever minimal amount of money it costs to get that kind of peace of mind is great. So what do? I call my friend Mike Porcelli, who's the co-host of the Auto Lab and the best mechanic in America, only person that could fix anything. And I said, "Mike, you know, I'm sorry to bother you on a Sunday," because this is exactly what he wants to do on a Sunday, is field phone calls from me about my latest drama. And lo and behold, Mike, within minutes, springs into action, finds Deborah on the side of the Long Island Expressway, helps put the donut on her car, and then takes her in her car to a tire shop where Dennis Smith of Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Jericho, he's the manager there. Even though they said they were too busy initially, Dennis Smith says, no, we'll help her. And so he basically comes to her rescue and gets her a new tire on that car. So this is a dual commendation for Mike Porcelli for rescuing my sister-in-law, Deborah, on the side of the highway in Long Island, and to Dennis Smith of Goodyear in Jericho for making sure that she was serviced and was able to drive first to her mother's and then back home to Lakewood, New Jersey. So I'll tell you, if I'm ever in the market for a tire on Long Island, I am going to Goodyear, and I'm asking for Dennis Smith, and I hope you do too. He's a great guy. Even if you're in the Jericho area, pop in there and tell them you heard what a hero Dennis was, helping this young woman out with two small children. You can imagine, they were stranded on the side of the road for hours. You can imagine how thrilled, I think one of them is 8 and one of them is 6. You can imagine how thrilled they must have been just to be, when it's 90 degrees, to be stranded on the side of the road. I'm sure they were just having the time of their life. Now, I spoke about him a little bit on Thursday, but I want to give a formal, posthumous commendation to Timothy Green Beckley. He was a UFO expert, a terrific UFO author, somebody that published all sorts of books about aliens. His most recent one is Alien Lives Matter. And he was a great publisher of books, and he was really juiced in to the UFO community. And he helped me get so many great guests who were experts in aliens and ufology since we've been doing the show for the last, 9 months. He was really such a big part of this show, particularly early on, and such a big help. And he's passed away. We don't know how he died. The cause of his death is still unknown. He was a great New Yorker and a great lover of radio. And he's somebody that I came to call a friend, and he's somebody that I'm going to miss. He was remarkably accomplished. He was very intelligent. He was very good on the radio. And you know what? What counts for the most in my book, he was just a nice guy. So I'm giving him a posthumous commendation, and I'm sorry I'm not going to get to interview him again. He was a terrific person and a guy that devoted the bulk of his life to exploring the paranormal and the unknown, and he worked hard at it. I want to commend 17-year-old Haley Marinico, a 17-year-old Southern California girl who got into a shoving match with a bear in order to protect her dogs, and she walked away unscathed. Haley Marinico and her mother were gardening in Bradbury, California last Monday when a bear and her cubs began walking atop a cinder block wall at one end of the garden. And you see video of this encounter. It shows the appearance of the family of black bears on the short wall, and it set off one of Haley's dogs, which began barking and lunging at them. So then the bear, what do? If you're a mama bear and your cubs are being attacked. So mama bear starts swatting at the large dog and the three small ones that had joined this canine versus bear confrontation. So this commotion obviously is going to catch Haley's attention. So without thinking, she runs over to defend her dogs. She ran over to see what they were barking at, and it's not a dog, it's a bear. She sees the bear, and it's grabbing her dog, Valentina. And she runs over there, and the first thing this 17-year-old woman thinks to do is push the bear. And she did. And it worked. So then Haley throws her hands up in the air. She pushes the large bear off the wall. The cubs were frightened by the loud barking. They had already hightailed it out of there. Haley scoops up one of the smaller dogs, and then she and all the pets all ran in the opposite direction. Now, I would not recommend this, but this is a little girl, not a girl, but this is a young woman that has a lot of gumption and a lot of bravery. For her to protect her dogs and get into a shoving match with a bear, that's a lot of courage. And hats off to you, Haley. Hats off to you, Haley Marinico. I want to commend Anheuser-Busch. I'm not a big Anheuser-Busch fan. I find most of the beer that they make pretty mediocre, nothing special about it. It's the kind of beer you drink when there's nothing else better to drink. Am I right? But I do like what they're doing. So if we as a country reach Joe Biden's vaccination goal by July 4th of 70% of Americans getting at least one dose of the vaccine, Anheuser-Busch, which is the largest beer company in the world, not in the world, but in the United States, is offering Americans free beer if the country reaches this goal. That's very nice. So everyone's going to get a free beer if 70% of the country gets vaccinated. Very, very nice. I love to see that. All right. And I want to commend dried fruit. You know, I like dried fruit. Love a good apricot. Love some raisins, some dried dates. Honestly, I don't think there's a dried fruit that I don't like. But you always kind of hear that dried fruit was not the best for you. Maybe there was a little too much sugar. Maybe it was a little too high calorie. You're better off just eating an apple, eating some grapes, rather than go with the dried fruit. Well, now, a new study shows that dried fruits need to be on your to-eat list. And this study, the study shows that subjects who ate dried fruit were shown to have healthier diets, lower body mass index, and smaller waists than those who don't eat dried fruit. So apparently, everyone has the idea of eating sugar in their snacks is bad for you. That's what I always thought. We all know that by eating simple carbs, this causes soaring blood sugar, which triggers insulin, which sends the message to the body to store any extra calories that are not needed in that moment as fat. Unfortunately, this also leads people to stay away from dried fruit. That's what I always did, because I always thought that the fructose was bad for you. So this recent study found that people who eat dried fruit are healthier than those who don't eat it. Despite the fact that you may be smartly staying away from sugar, you should not sweep fruit up in that thought. So the next time a craving strikes, instead of giving in to the sweets that contain sugar, swap out those cookies or chips with dried fruit, according to this study out of Penn State University. Researchers found that on days when the study subjects ate dried fruits, including all the ones that I just mentioned, they consumed more key nutrients than on days when they skipped the dried fruit. And the dried fruit was found to fill in nutritional gaps in an individual's diet, which led to increased energy, focus, improved long-term health, lower inflammation, and decreased risk of disease. That's great news. For me, as somebody that loves dried fruit, I will be reaching for those raisins the next time. Stay away from that granola bar. Pick up the raisins. Great news indeed. Hey, speaking of health, I want to commend Nathan's. Nathan's Famous is now offering vegan hot dogs. You know, I love the whole hot dog culture. But, look, you don't need me to tell you this. A Frankfurter is one of the worst things you can consume on the planet. I mean, it's so incredibly bad for you. I think Ralph Nader used to call them red missiles of death, right? Because they are so – it would be difficult for – you know how they came up with coronavirus in a lab, supposedly? Come up with a really dangerous virus that could kill all sorts of people? That's essentially the food – the Frankfurter is the food equivalent of that. I don't think scientists could come up with a worse food for you. Let's not see them try. So anyway, Nathan's Famous, which is one of the biggest hot dog franchisers in the whole country, they are now going to be offering a vegan hot dog at all their locations. So I think this is great. So beginning today, you can now order a meatless hot dog at all sorts of Nathan's locations. So I think that's great news. It's great for people that don't eat meat. It's great for people that just don't want all the nitrates and the fat of a Frankfurter. It's great news. I want to commend Magawa. Magawa is a hero rat. Yes, you heard me correctly. He is a rat and a hero who is retiring from his job of detecting landmines. Now, this rat has been awarded a gold medal for his heroism. And in his five-year career, this rodent has sniffed out 71 landmines and dozens of more unexploded items in Cambodia. Now, he's a cute little rat, I must say. He's only 7 years old, but he's incredibly well-trained. But now he's starting to slow down as he reaches old age. And there are thought to be 6 million landmines in Cambodia, which is pretty scary when you think about it. And this rat has been certified as a detector of landmines, and he does a pretty good job, as you could tell. So he's had a great career, and I wish him the absolute best. I want to commend Essential Quality, the winner of the 2021 Belmont Stakes. Congratulations to you. And I penultimately want to commend Honolulu. That has been named by Wallet Hub as the best city to take a staycation. Not a surprise there. We'll check in with Sid Rosenberg in the 5 o'clock hour to find out if that's true. Wallet Hub looked at 180 cities to determine the best places in the country for a staycation. Honolulu was at the top of its list for the number of recreational activities. So congratulations to Honolulu. Lastly, I have to give a commendation to my friend Dominic Carter. Now, I've enjoyed following Dominic Carter since he's been on every night at midnight. Obviously not Sunday into Monday, but the rest of the week I follow him. But I got to tell you, the work that he has been doing is extraordinary. Not only is he doing great work on the radio, getting great interviews, he's on 6 days a week. He's on Sunday nights at 9 p.m., and then he's on Monday through Friday at midnight. But this week, he filled in for Greg Kelly for 2 hours in the afternoon. And on Friday morning, he did his show live at midnight. He went and got a hotel room on his own, slept for a couple hours, was back here at 5 a.m., got 4 hours of sleep, was back here at 5 a.m., and filled in on the air for Bernie and Sid from 6:30 to 10, did a great job, and then was back on the air live Friday night at midnight. Now, I've never seen a work ethic like this. This is extraordinary. And I got to tell you, I've always been a friend and a fan of Dominic's. Watching him is so inspiring, and it makes me want to work even harder. So I'll tell you, he's the best kind of influence and the best kind of colleague, and I give him a wholehearted commendation for all that. All right, 800-848-9222. We're going to get into your phone calls in just a minute. Meantime, my friend Mike Porcelli, who was the proud recipient of a commendation along with Dennis Smith of Goodyear Tire in Jericho, was kind enough to call in. Mike, thank you again for your role in helping out my sister-in-law, Deborah, yesterday.
Good morning, Frank. You're welcome. I want to commend you on your commendations.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So people that don't know you, Mike, you're a star auto mechanic. You've got just about every mechanic certification there is. You've worked in shops and had your own shops for a long time. You've also been the co-host of a very long-running auto repair show on the radio called The Auto Lab. Now, these days, it's just heard online, but it would be – hopefully it will come back to the radio soon. I'd love to have it on our station, but that's kind of your background. But what could people learn from my sister-in-law's, Deborah's experience, and how can it be treated as sort of a cautionary tale?
Well, definitely. As I was helping Deborah, I realized that there's a lot of things that people need to know about her experience. Number one, when I got there, she had a husband on the phone who told me where the key to the wheel locks was. Very hard to change a tire if you don't have the key to the wheel locks. So, and Deborah had no idea where the key was. Luckily, she got a husband on the phone who told me where it was. So the first thing to know is, and when you're driving a vehicle, you need to know what equipment you have. You have to know that you have all the right equipment to be able to change a tire if necessary. Even if you don't know how to do it, if you're going to call somebody like me, you have to be able to give me the key, right? So first thing is you have to know where the key is and where all your tools are. Make sure you have a spare tire that's not flat. I was able to get the tire off, put the spare tire on, and then I didn't want to just leave her alone to go off and fend for herself to try and get another tire. Initially, I thought the tire might be able to be repaired, be plugged or patched. So we went to the nearest tire shop, which happened to be the Goodyear shop. And like you said, initially the salesman said that they were too busy. But then I spoke to Dennis, the manager, who said he was not going to leave a woman stranded, you know, in another state with two kids. So he took care of us right away. And it turned out that the tire was not repairable because the inside of the tire had been destroyed by driving on it while it was flat.
Mm.
Now, the reason I wanted to call is a lot of places would have patched the tire. Dennis told me he was not allowed, by company policy, he was not allowed to patch a tire in that condition because he would then be putting a dangerous tire on somebody's vehicle. So I wanted to make sure your listeners know that if you do have a flat, you have to open up the tire and make sure the inside of the tire is checked. Because if the tire casing is destroyed and you go and patch it or plug it and go back on the road, you could be driving a dangerous tire.
Well, so that's good advice. So one, first and foremost, is – well, first, I would add, and this is not your admonition, it's mine. I would add that I think people should pay the whatever nominal fee it is to be a member of AAA, because I think that does bring you a lot of peace of mind. Two, you would add know what equipment you have, how to access it, and where it is. And three, know when it's appropriate to patch a tire and when not to.
Well, at least I will go to somebody, a professional, who's going to give you the right advice. There are many tire shops springing up all over town, and they would have just happily plugged that tire and sent it on away.
Mm.
And who knows what could have happened.
Well, so how do you know, Mike, as a consumer, if you go to one of these tire shops, how do you know whether that you're going to a tire shop where you can trust their judgment of patching a tire versus replacing it?
These little, what I call, you know, fly-by-night or pop-up tire shops, they're springing up all over the place. They generally sell used tires. They'll patch and plug tires. They're not what I would say are really professional tire shops.
Well, but a place like Goodyear, that's your ticket. That's where you should do.
You want to make sure anytime you're dealing with any kind of automotive professional, you want to make sure you're dealing with a professional. Not somebody, you know, who's sort of just fly by night. One other thing you mentioned, I want to commend you for recommending AAA. We recommend AAA on our show all the time. In fact, they're on our show just about every week. But you, Frank, belong to Quadruple A, which is one better than AAA. That's the always available automotive assistance.
That's what I get for being friends with you. Well, Mike, thank you again.
Personal Road Service Club.
Thank you again. And if people want to listen to your show on the weekends, how can they do it?
Well, right now you can go to Facebook. Just Google Autolab Radio Facebook, and you'll find us. You can listen to the entire year's worth of shows there. And we do hope to be back on air, hopefully with you very soon.
Great. Great, Mike. Well, thank you again, and I appreciate it a great deal. You're a lifesaver today, from my perspective.
And don't give everybody my personal number, because not everybody qualifies for quadruple assistance.
Believe me, I'm keeping it close to the vest. Thank you, Mike.
All right. Thank you.
Great Mike Porcelli. 800-848-9222. Your calls are welcome on any subject next. 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Say the horror on the road is forbidden. And from what I've seen, I believe I'm now the other, maybe barely breathing. But the horror on the road's forbidden. LA, Hollywood, in the sunset.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Hey, yesterday was D-Day, the 77th anniversary of D-Day. We're going to break that down with David Pietruzza next hour. He's going to join me for just about the full hour until we get to 15 seconds of fame. This is long-form interview week. We are going to find a series of compelling guests on a wide variety of subjects to tell you interesting stories, to also take your calls tomorrow. In the 1 o'clock hour, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick is going to be here. And then in the 2 o'clock hour, one of our resident UFO experts, Bill Burns, is going to be here. We're going to talk with him about what we're learning about the leaks surrounding this Pentagon UFO report. Very interesting. Also very interesting to see Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator's comments on that yesterday. The story is not going away, folks, so we're going to stay on top of it as long as we need to. We'll talk a little bit about boxing when we come back in a few minutes. I went a little long in the last segment with commendations and then the Mike Porcelli call, and I will take your calls. Wide open phones right now if you want to jump on board. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. And I will tell you that I have just been hooked on these A&E biography documentaries on these various wrestlers. It's part of this WWE Legends series. Now, it's been a long time since I watched wrestling on a regular basis, but I used to be, for a long, long time, obsessive
in watching professional wrestling. And I still read books on professional wrestling and do a lot of research about the eras of professional wrestling that I used to follow. And when I was a kid, my whole day, every moment of my day, would be spent looking for an opportunity to talk about professional wrestling. That's what I would do always. If I would go with my dad to his work or help him buy a car, I would talk to any stranger that I could find if they wanted to have a conversation about wrestling. Didn't matter what the conversation was. Sometimes they'd say, oh, well, I haven't watched professional wrestling since, Bruno Sammartino beat Buddy Rogers. And then I would say, oh, tell me about that. And I would ask them all sorts of questions about whatever aspect of professional wrestling they were interested in. So I have to tell you, since I've been watching these documentaries, and so far I've seen – there's eight of them. I've seen Stone Cold Steve Austin. I've seen The Macho Man Randy Savage, The Ultimate Warrior, Mick Foley, and Rowdy Roddy Piper. So there are three left. I think it's Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, and Booker T. I am basically of the same mindset that I was when I was 10 years old. I was at a family function Saturday. I was with my dad and his family as my brother Nicholas and his girlfriend Kat, her parents came into town from Texas. It was our first time meeting them, and big shout out to them, Barry and Marcia McInnes. Marcia's a big, big fan of the show. All I would do is wait for somebody to bring up wrestling. And the whole day I was spending waiting for someone to talk about wrestling. Of course, no one did. Sunday, I was at my mother-in-law's house with five or six of my eight siblings-in-law. There was a little more wrestling talk there. Still not a lot of wrestling talk. But this series of documentaries has caused me to be transported back to my wrestling mindset of years ago. So if you're even a little bit interested in professional wrestling, I do recommend that series of documentaries. It's on A&E, WWE Legends. I did see another film on Saturday. It's a couple of years old now. It's a film called So This Is 40 with Paul Rudd. And it's a Judd Apatow movie. And it's kind of a sequel to Knocked Up. It's not really. You don't need to have seen Knocked Up to have to appreciate the story in this. But it's called This Is 40. And it's a comedy, as almost all these Judd Apatow films are. And it's about a couple in their, you know, turning 40 who deals with marriage and kids. It was cute. It was cute. It was enjoyable. It was an enjoyable 2 hours. Paul Rudd is great in everything. And Leslie Mann was also pretty good. John Lithgow and Albert Brooks are in it in supporting roles. I found it to be incredibly predictable. I thought that it was amusing, but not really funny. I didn't really laugh once out loud throughout the whole picture. So if you're looking for something lighthearted to kind of pass the time for 2 hours, there are worse movies that you can see, certainly. But if you're looking for something really funny, I don't think this fits the bill at all. And again, it's 9 years old at this point. So it's on Netflix. So if you wanted to see it, chances are by now you've probably seen it. But if you're a big Paul Rudd fan or a big Judd Apatow fan, and for whatever reason you haven't seen this one yet, it might be worth checking out. But trust me, if you don't see it, your life will continue pretty much as it was. I have been enjoying the CNN docu-series on the history of late night. Last night, they aired the final episode, I believe. But because my wife and I were driving back from Long Island, we didn't get to watch it. I'm hoping to catch it on demand today. I will tell you what I have been enjoying, the response that I've been hearing from so many of you regarding the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentile. If you've ever suffered a workplace injury or an occupational disease, you need to contact the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentile. Now, as our boss, John Catsimatidis, is fond of reminding me, we don't just reach New York City. We don't just reach New York State. We don't just reach the tri-state area. We reach 36 states. And even though they are very much a hometown law firm, they will take your workers' compensation case from wherever. So if you have a workers' compensation claim, call Angiuli and Gentile. They've been helping people like you for over 35 years. They take the fear out of the workers' compensation process. There are good folks who I know personally. They don't just do workers' comp, though. If you have a wrongful termination issue, they'll represent you. If you have a divorce issue or you want a premarital agreement of some sort, contact them. They're experts. They'll listen to your concerns and explain how all of this process works to you. They'll get you the medical treatment that you need and the workers' compensation payments that you're entitled to. The lawyers at Anjuli and Gentili have handled thousands of workers' compensation hearings, and they'll help you walk with confidence. Call Anjuli and Gentili today at 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-COMP. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. 888-234-COMP, 888-234-2667. Street fighting, man. I'll tell you, I realize this makes me a barbarian, a Neanderthal. I do like sports, some sports that involve fighting, namely wrestling and boxing. I've never gotten into mixed martial arts. For me, it's just not my thing. I know Bernie McGurk is really into that, and a lot of fans are. But to me, that's not my thing. But I've always really liked boxing. But I've really been frustrated as a fight fan at seeing what's happening to boxing as a sport over the last 10 or 15 years. Because when I was watching boxing as a kid, you'd have these gargantuan matches, these titans rushing to take on one another. Now that's not the case. Now, the only time anybody talks about any of these boxing matches, it's when there's a show, basically these exhibition matches that are a reality show with people in boxing gloves. Not really boxing. So last night, there was this big pay-per-view, $50 for this pay-per-view. I didn't pay for it. I didn't watch it. But if I got invited somewhere and I was free, I would have gone. But it's tough for me to be at these Sunday night events because it's, you know, doing the show and stuff. Anyway, so they had this boxing exhibition match between Floyd Mayweather Jr., 44 years old, fighting. Now, Floyd Mayweather's a real boxer. He's won every championship there is. Welterweight, cruiserweight, this weight, that weight, whatever. And a lot of people have said he's one of the best boxers of all time. And there is a case to be made for that. So he was fighting this guy who's a YouTube star, Logan Paul, which, again, I want to reiterate, is one of the reasons it's so important for me to become a social media star so that I can participate in boxing matches like this and people will pay. Floyd Mayweather made $100 million for this pay-per-view last night. $100 million. Now, that's huge. So he is a champion in multiple divisions, Mayweather, and Logan Paul is a YouTube star. And he's not somebody that I particularly like. He did that stunt where he visited this suicide village in Japan and showed somebody that had just killed themselves in a YouTube video. Now, he did apologize, but I thought that was very telling that he thought that was appropriate to show. So they fought last night at Miami's Hard Rock Stadium. Eight 3-minute rounds, no judges. So what does that mean? That means if no one gets knocked out, there's no winner. And that was the case. No one got knocked out, so there was no winner. And by the way, I give Logan Paul, who's not really a boxer, a lot of credit, even though he's 20 years younger almost than Floyd Mayweather, for him to be able to go the distance of 8 rounds with one of the best fighters of all time. That is extraordinary. for a non-boxer. Floyd Mayweather Jr. commented on this after the match.
I wanted to get the people on the show, and he was fighting to survive, as you guys can see. Every time he punched, he'd clinch. Every time he'd punch, he'd clinch. He was the bigger guy, and a little awkward. Well, his background is wrestling, if I'm not mistaken, so he was good at tying me up. So a guy that came in over 200 and some pounds, I came in at 155, but no excuse. I had fun tonight, and, you know, I go out there to put on a show, and I really believe that he was, you know, just going a distance. That was a win for him, so he was happy with going a distance.
Floyd, he seemed pretty fatigued by the middle part of the fight. Were there times where you felt that you hurt him and maybe even could have gotten him out of there?
He can grapple. Yeah. He's good with holding. He's very, very good with holding. And like I said before, his background is wrestling. So, you know, when a guy over 200 and some pounds holding you, you know, I'm trying my best. Even though I got a lot of experience, but it's hard to get a guy, a heavyweight off you. Yeah. You know, I fight at welterweight, fighting a heavyweight. Like I said before, I had fun. I'm pretty sure he had fun. You know, he was so the brothers, Jake as well as Logan, were so happy that his brother was able to go the distance. So it was cool.
So understand what we saw yesterday, what Floyd Mayweather got paid $100 million for, and what fans all around the country, probably all around the world, paid $50 for on pay-per-view, was not a boxing match. It was a celebrity circus. And they had an undercard as well where Chad Ocho Cinco Johnson made his boxing debut on the undercard. Christian, you're our resident sportsmeister until Sid Rosenberg gets here. Who is Chad Johnson again?
He was an NFL player. He played for the Cincinnati Bengals and a couple other teams. He was on the Philadelphia Eagles for a while. So he's a football player.
And who do you know anything about who he fought yesterday?
No. These are, as you're saying,
they're
shticked. Yeah. And I mean, as I'm sure as a boxing fan, because I know you do actually appreciate the sport,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is probably the best thing that could happen to the sport because –
debate about that.
You could hate that, but younger generation of fans don't care about boxing.
Well, you're right. Well, so Chad Johnson, by the way, so he was pretty impressive last night from what reporters are saying, but he did end up getting knocked down in the fourth round by a big right hook from Brian Maxwell. Now, Brian Maxwell is a bare knuckle fighter who is 0-3 with two losses. He was also 0-1 in standard boxing fights and 2-3 in MMA fights. So he's a real fighter. So, I mean, it's not surprising that he was able to outlast. Now, as Christian was saying, so first of all, you have this guy Logan Paul, who's a YouTube star and a social media influencer, which is what we're trying to make me, which is why we need you to go to my Facebook page right now, facebook.com/MoranoFan, and click like. So Logan Paul and his brother Jake have turned to boxing as a way to capitalize on their internet fame. Jake knocked out a former MMA fighter, Ben Askren, at an April exhibition match that earned Jake Paul a reported $10 million. The guy's a YouTube star. The guy just sits there and makes YouTube videos, and he was able to turn this into enough of an industry that he's getting paid $10 million to fight a real fighter. And his next foe, Jake Paul, will be former MMA champion Tyler Woodley. Over 1 million people paid to watch Logan Paul's first fight with fellow social media star KSI on YouTube, and their 2019 match was one of the social media platform's biggest events of the year. So the big picture, as Christian was saying, a lot of people believe that these bouts, these exhibition matches where you have celebrities fighting real fighters, I don't even call them celebrities. We have social media influencers fighting real fighters. A lot of people believe that these can exist alongside real boxing without doing any harm. Other people think, and I think I'm probably in this camp, other people think that it makes a mockery of the sport. And it turns what has been considered a prideful profession into nothing more than just more social media content. This is what Logan Paul told ESPN. My goal is to be the biggest entertainer on the planet. And putting on big fights and big shows as a freelance fighter is a good way to do that. So the rise of these sideshow bouts, I guess we'll call them, was driven by the social media age that we're now living in. But to Christian's point, and he's right about this, it's also to some extent a result of real boxing, air quotes, real boxing, and Axios wrote about this on Saturday, real boxing failing to entertain people. There's more money in boxing now than ever, and there are more outlets eager to televise it. But the biggest boxers aren't fighting each other. That's according to Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. So you used to have days of fighters demanding fights, and instead that's been replaced by fighters asking for fights if the promoter can make it and if it won't tick off another network too much. Well, where are the days of Holyfield demanding a shot at fighting Tyson, of Lennox Lewis demanding a shot at fighting Holyfield, of George Foreman demanding to fight Muhammad Ali? You know, all these other folks, you know. So as boxing, just as boxing purists fear, this is from Axios, celebrity bouts are grabbing more attention than the top tier fights. That's according to a May survey done by the Harris Poll and provided to Axios. 40% of Americans heard about the Mayweather-Paul fight. 30% heard about the Paul-Askren fight. Now, those are the fake boxing matches. Only 29% heard about the Tyson Fury Dante Wilder rematch of their prior heavyweight title fights. Now, that's a real boxing match. Only 29% of people heard about that, but 40% of people heard about this show that took place last night. And only 19% heard about Josh Taylor boxing Jose Ramirez for the unified junior welterweight title. So for whatever reason, nobody cares about real boxing anymore. The only kind of boxing people care about is these shows where you take people that aren't boxers, stick them in a ring, sometimes with other fighters, sometimes with other celebrities, and you make it into a social media event. That's the era in which we're living. That's why, you know what, if you can't beat them, join them. We should demand that they do a rematch of Bernie McGurk boxing Sid Rosenberg. Now, that was a big deal 10 or 11 years ago, whenever they did that. If boxing is back now, and that's the big thing now, why don't we do that? Why don't we have a rematch of Bernie McGurk versus Sid Rosenberg? I think it was called Fear at the Pier. Do you remember that? Was that what it was called?
Fear at the Pier, yeah. Bernie was actually talking about it the other week when he was on Friday with Lauren Conlon. Not on air, but they were having a conversation about it, yeah.
What was he saying?
Well, because he was like kind of giving Lauren fighting tips, and he mentioned that him and Sid fought a couple years ago. It's worth it. It's on YouTube if anyone wants to go find it. It's hilarious to watch.
Okay. Very interesting. All right. Well, yeah, I think we're about to for a Bernie versus Sid 2. 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We're going to talk D-Day next hour with accomplished historian and author David Pietruzza, one of my favorite historians, one of my favorite authors, and a real expert on D-Day. He'll join me for the hour as we analyze what happened 77 years ago yesterday and why that is still so significant. 1-800-848-9222. It's your opportunity to be heard. 1-800-848-WABC. Ralph is in New Jersey. Hello, Ralph.
Okay, since you will have a guest pertaining to the D-Day, okay, two things that leave a lasting impression on me about the D-Day is a movie, The Longest Day.
Oh, love that film. That's John Wayne and Sean Connery, right?
I only remember one actor in there, Frankie, to be honest with you, okay? And that is Paul Anka. And that's the reason why I have to, watch that black and white Hollywood production. And they are pretty extensive in dealing with the D-Day. The strategy and planning on the days leading up to the D-Day and the actual D-Day itself. It was in the outline in the book, Body Guard of Lies, and then the Longest Day. Now, you deliver the newscast at the top of the hour, and you mentioned Anthony Blinken, okay? And quote-unquote, vitals from the lab, okay? My question, it's a two-part question, and Judge Jeanine didn't have the opportunity to get the second question that I want to ask. The first question is, and with regard to Joseph Biden, why do you think he abolished the task force that in the State Department that looked into the origin of, the virus from the Wuhan lab and the role that the CCP is played into that thing? And the number two question, what is holding back Nancy Pelosi to issue a waiver about the FSIA? I know it rhymes like Pfizer, but the FSIA is the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. If there's a waiver on that, I'll be the first one to knock on the door of, Arthur Aidala, and you say, and I will tell him, we're going to go sue China. China will have a day in court. And not just me, but average American all across this country.
Well, you said a mouthful there, Ralph. I can't answer your question as to why, but I will say, look, China bears a lot of culpability here. And this is not something that should be viewed through a partisan lens, because I'll be honest, something very interesting has happened since Biden's been president. He has been much softer on Russia than Donald Trump was, and he's actually been a little tougher on China than Donald Trump was, if you could believe that. And the both of those do kind of surprise me. The Russia thing, not so much, but the China aspect of it does surprise me a little bit. And China is going to have to pay the piper here. And China's in the midst of trying to become the global superpower in the world. And I think they should have to pay reparations for everything that they caused, because their failure to get a handle on this, their deception to the world, the fact that this could have very easily been the result of something that came out in a lab, their failure to be transparent now, I think they owe the United States and the effective businesses here some money. And I would love to see the United States government, including President Biden, hold their feet to the fire on this, because China has been an international embarrassment in terms of their handling of this COVID crisis. At least that's as far as I'm concerned. Hey, we're going to talk D-Day next with historian David Pietruzza. This is a conversation you are not going to want to miss. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Have your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
It's Monday. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. And yesterday was the 77th anniversary of one of the most remarkable achievements in the history of not only American history, but in the history of human civilization. I'm talking, of course, about D-Day. You want to talk about something that, if it would have gone differently, would have altered the entire course of human history. That's what we're saying about D-Day. And I thought it might be appropriate to look back at the importance of exactly what transpired there and tell you some information that you might not know about it. Here to guide us through what happened 77 years ago is one of my favorite historians, David Pietruzza. He's also a terrific author. He's written a lot of great history books. We'll mention a couple of them throughout the hour, and he's somebody that I turn to all the time when looking back at analyzing historical events. David, thank you for getting up early for us.
Oh, no problem. I'm up. I'm ready to go.
So, David, most of the people in our audience are not going to remember D-Day and what happened 77 years ago. Before we get into D-Day itself and the invasion and what happened, set the stage for us. Where was World War II at that point in June 6th? What was going on at that point in the war? How did it look for both sides?
Well, I think at that point, Allied victory was a given. But, you know, the Nazis being fanatical, they weren't about to give up at all. They were, you know, brainwashed, really, under the mesmerized by Hitler. And there was, so the fighting was going on since 1941 in Russia. The Russians were moving the Germans back, but at a terrific cost. They're going to lose 20 million people in the war. In the Pacific, again, we've turned the tide. Midway was in, I think it was in 1942, so we've been moving them back. But, you know, it's going to take two atomic bombs to convince them to give up. On the European front, after a tough fight, the Allies had finally pushed the Axis powers, Italy and Japan and Germany, out of North Africa. Tobruk was the big battle there. And then we moved on to, well, a second front. The German, or the Stalin, is pressing the Western Allies for this so-called second front. He wants it in France. Roosevelt wants it in France. Churchill is very nervous about that. He's seen how the fighting in France could go in World War One, which is trench warfare and fighting for every, not just every mile, but for every yard of French soil, and the tremendous casualties that occurred, like in the Battle of the Somme. So is that a good play to him? He has to be convinced. And so he wants to strike at the soft underbelly of Europe, which involves an invasion of Sicily and then an invasion of the Italian boot. The Italians are knocked out of the war at that time, right about, I think it's the day before. Wow. D-Day. Italy finally surrenders. Rome is taken, rather. And so you've got movement there, but, you know, we're not going to take all of Italy at all, even before the end of the war. It's that tough a battle. So where do you come into France? And that's the issue.
All right. So then the invasion itself, why is this such a big deal? What makes this particular D-Day invasion different from other invasions that might have taken place in World War II and in other battles and other wars?
Well, it's just so much more heavily defended. The Germans have created this Atlantic Wall. This is the idea of Hitler, that you are going to protect the entire western coast of Europe. And he does it, you know, only, you know, a quarter of the German army is sitting there from Norway all the way to the Spanish border through France, the Low Countries, to protect against an Allied invasion. These are people who could be fighting on the Soviet Eastern Front. They could be fighting in the Balkans. They could be fighting in Italy. But they're pinned down there. And he has his troops there. And late 1943, he takes one of Germany's best commanders, Erwin Rommel, puts him as the inspector and ultimately head of Army Group B to make sure that an Allied invasion is going to be stopped. Now, what does he do? He's going to utilize the troops. He wants to stop them at the beach. He says this thing has to be won in the first 24 hours. And he says this will be the longest day. He's the guy who coins that phrase. It's not the book, it's the general. And he spends the months leading up to D-Day mining the beaches with millions of mines, putting up these Czech barriers, these sort of Czech hedgehogs, these metal barriers to stop tanks, mining one thing after another, flooding the areas behind the fortifications to make this as difficult as and impossible for the Allies. Now, what happens if they fail? Obviously, if they fail, a lot of people are going to get killed. But if they fail, the Allies are not going to be able to just, oh, let's do this next weekend, okay? It could be put off for another year. And then you've got those 1.5 million German soldiers, and they could be shifted to those fronts, and they could make a tremendous difference on any one of them. So it's going to cost not only the lives of the men on the beaches, but it's going to cost people on the other fronts, the civilians, not just the military is being killed in this war, but the civilian cost in terms of the Holocaust, in terms of the bombings. This is just immense and unprecedented in human existence.
How long did the battle or battles that took place on D-Day actually last?
The battles on D-Day... Well, it's going on forever, and of course the battles are going on all the way to the end of VE Day, victory in Europe. But they start in the early. They start actually the night before with paratroop drops. You have 20,000. Now, people, we think about the beaches. We say there's 153,000 men who land on D-Day, but only about 120,000 really land on the beaches, 130,000. Another 20,000 land behind enemy lines. They're either paratroopers, they're parachuting in, or they are landing on gliders with the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions. So they're coming in early, and then when the sun rises, then you have this absolutely immense armada of 6,330 ships, 120 warships, 3,500 troop carriers, 500 cargo carriers, 600 specialty craft. They're all coming in, and they're coming in thanks to the presence of boats, which really don't get a lot of credit in this, but 250 minesweepers. You've got to clear a path before our men can get into the beaches. So it's going to last all the way through the night. And then, you know, our objectives. Okay, it's a tremendous victory, except now what are the specific goals for D-Day itself? It's to seize four major cities or towns in back of the five beaches on which we land, and in fact, we seize none of them. And when I say we, I mean the Americans who land at two beaches, the British who land at two beaches, the Canadians who land at the fifth beach, and to link up these five bridgeheads, these landing zones, and we don't do that either. So it's the Germans make an incredible amount of mistakes in terms of intelligence and deciding what to do once they know an invasion is coming in the Normandy area, and yet they put up a hell of a fight, a hell of a fight.
We're talking with David Pietruzza, noted historian and an author and an expert in the D-Day invasion. If you want to call in with a question, we will take your calls. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. David, who were the key organizers of the Allied effort at D-Day? Who were the main architects? We've heard a lot about some of these names in history over the course of the last 77 years, but some names we may not have heard. Who deserves the credit for the planning of the D-Day invasion?
There's a British captain who or colonel who does that. And that plan is put together early on in 1942. They have to decide where they're going to land. And those landings could land in Norway. They could land in Normandy. They could land in another part of the Normandy Peninsula further up near the port of Cherbourg. They have to capture a port at some point in order to get men in. This is really a battle not only of arms. This is a battle of logistics. It's not just men who are going to arrive on the beaches. It's going to be tons and tons of equipment, both vehicles, fighting vehicles, support vehicles, supplies, or will land at the Pas-de-Calais in the north of France. And the Pas-de-Calais is the part of France which is nearer to England, which is nearest to England, which is a shorter trip across the English Channel. Most of the Germans think that the invasion is going to come there. And, you know, this is to the north is where the fighting has been in the First World War. It's been where the fighting has been in the Second World War when the Germans come in and sweep through France and come to victory. It's very near to Dunkirk and where the British had to have that successful evacuation in 1940. So that's certainly a choice the Allies have to make. One of the key things is weather. The English Channel is very choppy. It can be horrible. So you have to pick out the right time to invade. The original date for D-Day was not June 6th. It was June 5th. And on June 4th, a British meteorologist, a Colonel James Stagg, has to see Eisenhower and give him the bad news that the weather, and there had been like a 3-day window, which would be the best time to come in early June. Actually, it was originally set for May. It was originally set for May, but it had to be scrubbed for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons why it got scrubbed is, okay, so things could go wrong on D-Day. Things went wrong earlier in two big disasters for the Allies. The first of which was at a place called Dieppe in 1942. Dieppe is to the south, and it was something called Operation Jubilee, and it was designed to draw out the Luftwaffe and to practice a landing, to take a port, the port of Dieppe, to boost morale, and also to give the Canadians something to do. The Canadians had been sitting around in England since about 1940 and you know, just sort of going stir crazy. And this was an absolute disaster. They lost about, they landed like 6,000 men and lost about 4,000. So things can go bad. And why? Insufficient naval bombardment, insufficient softening up from the air. The fighting was too tough within the city itself. So it's like, okay, maybe you don't want to land within a city. Maybe you want to land on beaches like Normandy. The plan was too rigid. It was like 100 pages long, and it was inflexible. So the Allies learned from that. But then even right before the invasion, a few months before that, they have some training exercises in the south of England. And at a place called Slapton Sands, they lose. They have 20,000 men practicing. 20,000 men just practicing in one place. And they are attacked by some German E-boats. And what happens is they lose 729 men. Wow. Just in a training exercise. This is covered up. This is covered up by the American government until
David,
1984.
Let me ask you to pause because we have to take a break. But if you don't mind sticking around, I want to ask you a little bit more about that aspect of this invasion, how it was kept secret and the lengths to which it was kept secret and the importance of secrecy in planning the D-Day invasion. We're talking with David Pietruzza, best-selling author and historian, one of my favorite historians, talking about D-Day, the 77th anniversary of D-Day yesterday. If you want to call in with questions, you can do so. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I will tell you about one of my favorite law firms. That's the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentili. If you've ever suffered a workplace injury or an occupational disease has turned your life upside down, you must call the Staten Island law firm of Angiuli and Gentili. They'll get you paid while you're out of work. They'll get your work-related medical bills paid. The law firm of Angiuli and Gentili has been helping people like you for over 35 years. They'll help you take the fear out of the workers' compensation process. These are good folks who I know personally. They'll meet with you, listen to your concerns, and explain how all of this works for you. They'll get you the medical treatment and the workers' compensation payments you're entitled to. The lawyers at Angiuli and Gentili have handled thousands of hearings and will help you walk with confidence. Call Angiuli and Gentili today at 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-COMP. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. That number again, 888-234-COMP, 888-234-2667.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight, talking with one of my favorite historians, David Pietruzzo, who's written so many great books about history. 1960, all about the LBJ and JFK contest, and then the JFK-Nixon contest in the general election. 1920, the year of the six presidents. 1948, all about Harry Truman. TR's Last War, all about Theodore Roosevelt and his role in World War I. And his most recent book is Too Long Ago. I actually haven't read that one yet, but it's on my list. A Childhood Memory, A Vanished World, David Pietruzzo. David, what is Too Long Ago about? Is that a personal memoir?
It is. It goes all the way up from my birth and actually far before my birth, talking about the city where I grew up, Amsterdam, New York, which is, you know, upstate in the Mohawk Valley, one of the very early spots where the Rust Belt starts to rust, and the decay economically, manufacturing in the Northeast and in the United States starts to begin. And it's a tale of immigration, of the immigrant experience, in my case, Eastern European, Polish, about family, about growing up, and all the challenges that were faced then, and about what the world was like then in the 1950s, in the early 1960s. And, you know, it was very, very different from what people see now. And I want to explain it. I want to bring back memories for people who lived through it. I want to bring back, I want to talk to the people of today, the younger people of today, and even to the people who will follow us, and to put some things in context as to why we acted the way we did or didn't act the way we did.
Well, we're gonna have you back to talk about that book as soon as I read it, because I've been such a big fan of all of your other books. I have no doubt this is just as terrific. But we're talking about D-Day, 1944, a turning point in the war, World War II, a turning point in human history. David, you talk about the secrecy of this mission. How difficult was that? How much of a challenge was that for the organizers of this invasion and the people participating in the invasion to keep it a secret?
Well, the big slogan on the home front was "Loose lips sink ships." So secrecy and censorship were the bywords in World War II, and people really respected that. So it was a little easier than it is now where, you know, people would be tweeting about things or, you know, whether they were true or false. And they would kept this secret where you had so many Americans killed in part to save morale, to keep morale up. Also, because it was a little further off the coast than from Calais, you know, might this have been a tip off even more to the Germans if you put this out, even though they had led the attack? Did they even know how big an exercise they were attacking? They knew what they did. They sunk some ships, but did they know the full measure of what was going on? And it was only revealed in 1984, not because the government comes out with it, because a British housewife in that area of Devon, England, says, hey, they took these guys and they dumped them in a mass grave, and what the hell was going on there? And then the New York Times investigated, and the government finally fessed up to it. So, I mean, things were, I think, after the war, things kind of moved on. During the war, things were still being kept secret. And then there was just sort of an inertia to government secrecy.
800-848-9222. A lot of people may have questions for David Pietruzza. 1-800-848-9222. Let's say hello to Mark in North Carolina. Good morning, Mark.
Yes, good morning. One of my good friends, who's now deceased, was a young lieutenant on the staff of Teddy Roosevelt Jr., Clapton Sands, and he told me of an encounter he had with him. The only time he really interacted with him personally, they were observing the exercises before everything went bad, and it had started to rain. And so a senior officer told my friend, he said, it's raining, and General Roosevelt doesn't have a rain poncho, and you have an extra one. Go up there and offer it to him. So he went up there, and Roosevelt was peering through his, you know, glasses at the exercises, and he said, excuse me, General, he said, but I have an extra rain poncho for you. And he said he put down his binoculars from, you know, looking out to see, and his lips were very purple, of course, because he said he had very poor circulation. He was, I think, around 56 years old at the time, mm-hmm. Roosevelt was.
Exactly. At D-Day he was, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and so he had always had, you know, problems with arthritis and stuff too, so he walked with a cane. And he told my friend, he said, Lieutenant, he said, I didn't join this war to be comfortable, son, and went back to watching the exercise. So I just thought that was a really amazing anecdote. My friend, he landed at a D+6 and took his unit up into the hedgerows. They were fighting in the hedgerows at that time. And he told me a lot of the German snipers were laying low in the hedgerows, and they shot him in the leg. They would look for officers, you know, the snipers, and he showed me where the Mauser bullet hit him in the leg, so it was quite a wound. And he was not able to rejoin, you know, for several months. But I thought you would enjoy hearing that story, because as far as I know, I'm one of the few people that knows it, and now a lot of people do.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Mark.
What a great call.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Where do I start in commenting on that? Let's put it in three parts. One is Theodore Roosevelt Jr. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. had fought in France in World War I and was badly wounded in battles there. A brother of his, Quentin was killed. And another brother was very wounded, more so than Teddy Jr. And then he went off and was ran for governor of New York at one point, was undersecretary of the Navy, governor general of the Puerto Rico, and then of the Philippines, came back into active duty in World War II. And again, as the caller said very accurately, he was bothered by arthritis, walked with a cane, really had to beg to go on to the beach to land with his men. His commander, who gave the approvals, did and thought, wow, I am never going to see General Roosevelt again. He's not coming back. I mean, they didn't know how bad the losses were going to be. And as your caller said, T.R. Jr. was not in particularly great shape. But he lands on Utah Beach, which is the widest of the beaches. It's fairly lightly defended. It's not as bloody as bloody Omaha Beach by any measure, but the fighting is tough. And the tides, the weather, as we were talking about earlier, the tides would play havoc with the scheduling of the landings and where people would land. It would just sort of blow them over. And T.R. Jr. and his people are a mile off from where they're supposed to be. So he's on the beach and he's looking up and he sees this house on the beach, and it's like, hey, that's not supposed to be there. Nothing's right. It's like, holy cow, we're in the wrong place. What do we do? Do we march back to where we're supposed to be? Remember what I said about Dieppe, okay, how it's like they were inflexible. So Roosevelt decides we're going to be flexible, and he famously says, or maybe not, maybe it was his assistant or one of his underlings who claims later on that he said it, but the quote from Roosevelt is supposedly, the war starts from here. And what he did was he was very calm during the fighting, and he is directing traffic with his cane, sort of saying, you go here, you go there. He's an incredibly brave man in both wars. He's praised for that by Patton, and he's praised by that for Bradley, neither of whom, by the way, think he's a particularly good general or a commander. In fact, he's removed from a command at one point in the war before that with the concurrence of Bradley. But both of them say this, that he is one of the bravest guys they ever met.
We're gonna take
He dies a few weeks after that from a heart attack. He had suffered from pneumonia around this time, and then he has a heart attack and dies. His son serves on Omaha Beach, the next American beach over.
That, it's incredible, all those Roosevelts involved. FDR is the commander-in-chief, and then T.R. Jr., a general, and his son serving as part of the same invasion. That's wild. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue with your calls in just a minute. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Well, if you want to do something good for your own health, if you want to have greater energy and better digestion, then let me tell you about a product called Life Change Tea. You go to the website getthetea.com and you will be able to order the tea that makes you go. It's a cold tea, perfect for nice hot summer days like this. Nice ice cold glass of tea that is blended with a powerful herbal proprietary formula that gives you more energy without caffeine. It tastes terrific. There's no fillers. There's no GMOs. It's completely organic, and it's a mild cleanse. A daily detox that cleanses you from the inside out. Their slogan is, the tea that makes you go. Check out the reviews at getthetea.com. Again, the website is getthetea.com. When you order, if you use the promo code Frank at getthetea.com, you'll be able to save some money on shipping. In fact, you'll get to enjoy free shipping. So you get a great product at a great price. It gives you energy. It helps your digestive process. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Yesterday was the 77th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. We're talking with one of my favorite historians and authors, David Pietruzza. I highly recommend all of his books, whatever aspect of American history you're interested in, particularly in the 20th century, chances are he's written a book which fits the bill. His newest book is called Too Long Ago, A Childhood Memory of Vanished World. You can get it wherever books are available. David, before we go back to the callers, just go back to the secrecy aspect of things. I had read somewhere that one of the things they did was they had the BBC do an appeal for photographs to members of the public, but they couldn't actually tell the public what these photographs were for. Are you familiar with that? What exactly was that?
Yeah, it was photographs and it was postcards, and they eventually got 10 million replies or just descriptions of the French beaches. Now, you know, everyone knew there was going to be a landing. Hitler knew there was going to be a landing. Rommel knew. You know, it was, in a way, that was the worst kept secret of the war. But of course, it was going to be where. And so they had to get every little detail right of what was on those beaches. What were the houses on the front and on the shorefront. Now, the Germans got rid of some of them. They converted some of them into fortifications. All of those things were changed. Now, they took a huge number of aerial photos at various times of day, to then do something without the aid of computers to calculate simply what the gradient of the beach of the shore would be at certain times of day. They had a couple of commandos go in and land on the beaches, then come back out with samples of the soil. What's the soil going to be like? What is it going to comprise? Are you going to get stuck on the soil? They designed various types of tanks with flotation devices. One was called a Donald Duck. They called these tanks Hobart's Funnies because they had all these attachments to them, like flotation devices. They didn't want them sinking in the land. And a lot of our tanks sank before they got on shore, and the men didn't have the firepower support. It was very bad. Or because of the mines, they would have these big flailing chains in front of the tank, which, you know, just sort of beat the mine and then have it explode in front of you instead of under you. These hedgerows that were being referenced by your caller, what were those? Were those just bushes? What was so hard about them? Well, they weren't really bushes. They were mounds of dirt, and our tanks would get stuck on that. That was one of the surprises that we faced. We planned a lot of stuff. We couldn't plan anything. But there was a sergeant in the field who took some of the junked German barriers on the beach called Czech hedgehogs, and they welded them onto the beginning, to the front of our tanks, and made basically plows out of them to get rid of those earthen mounds. So all of those things. And snipers, what your caller was talking about. Another one of the very famous people who was at D-Day, and there were, you know, Yogi Berra was on one of the ships, but was a fellow named a Canadian on Juno, the Canadian beach, called Lieutenant James Doohan. Okay, so who's what's so famous?
Scotty,
about him?
Scotty,
Scotty
for the Canadian
exactly.
Army. Yes, absolutely.
That's
he
right.
lost his finger in that battle.
He did. You know the score.
Absolutely, I know my Star Trek, David.
He killed two German snipers. Okay, and his life was saved because a bullet hits his cigarette case. Smoking is good for you.
It's incredible. It's funny. He in his autobiography, there's a great chapter about his experience at D-Day, and he calls it, because he lost his finger there, he calls it, "I gave Hitler the finger." And and there's one Star Trek episode, it's called The Trouble with Tribbles, where you see Scotty holding these furry little creatures, Tribbles, and you see very clearly, and it's the only episode of Star Trek where this is visible, that he absolutely is missing a finger. But a lot of people very eager to comment and talk with you. 800-848-9222. Let me begin with Roy in Rye, New York. Roy, you're on with David Pietruzza.
Hey, thanks, David. I love the topic, and I really applaud you for having, you know, a historian of this stature on, especially since I don't think that, you know, June 6th never gets enough attention in my money, and it certainly didn't again this year. But two topics that have come up that I'd like to just hear more about, maybe expand on a bit, are both lessons and logistics. We talked about the lessons learned from, you know, slapped in sands, if they were learned, or from Dieppe. And if you think about what had already gone on. I mean, seaborne invasions, you know, were not a new thing at that point. But this was going to be, you know, different in scale and in nature than anything we had done. I mean, when we went into North Africa, really the first hostiles we encountered were the Vichy French. But even in those landings, we still had all kinds of crafts get swamped. There were all kinds of coordination problems, and
problems
there was
at Casablanca. Really, sure, Eisenhower was worried about that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the lessons from the Pacific didn't translate all that terrifically well, because they weren't, you know, they didn't need, you know, the logistical support, you know, or the operating tempo to actually, you know, to actually have a, you know, a 1,000-mile vision in terms of where they were going to go. They went to Tarawa, you know, or Bougainville. You know, those places were, you know, the size of a large farm compared to going into France, right? And you also at Dieppe, they encountered, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of what they encountered in the earliest stages were one of their areas that they had to operate in had cliffs. And that wasn't something that they were terrifically good at dealing with. And we learned a bit about that by the time that we went into Omaha, where the Rangers had to deal with that, you know, for
Point du Hoc is the famous situation there, and that's where Reagan gives his speech in Normandy and talks about the boys at Point du Hoc. But they have to scale a 100-foot cliff, shoot these rappelling devices up there, all sorts of ropes and ladders, and go up that cliff while the Germans are shooting down at them. And it's key why they have to do that. They have to do that because this is a point of land which sticks out into the English Channel right between our two American beaches, and it has six big artillery pieces on it, and it can be absolutely deadly in taking out ships or men at the beach. It has to be taken out. But as much as we spend time, talk about the great Allied deceptions of this operation, the one German deception I found out about was at Point du Hoc, where they had removed the guns, and our aerial reconnaissance was simply looking at the telephone poles painted black.
Wow.
And they had moved those guns. But the Allies, our guys, our command, our Rangers, had practice on cliffs that were 200 and 300 feet high. They were, you know, very tough guys, and they were prepared, and they were raring to go, even though they took tremendous casualties right in the first moments and all the way through. And then they find these six guns. They destroy them. They blow them up with grenades. They ruin the sights. But then they are the Germans counterattack them. They fight them off. They're a couple days later, Allied forces finally catch up to them, but they're in trouble. They've run out of supplies. They've run out of rations. They've run out of ammunition. They're using German guns and ammunition that they've captured. But what this does is it creates another problem, because when our guys hear firing from these German guns, they know the sound. They know it's not the sound of American guns, and the Americans start firing on them.
Wow. My final question, well, let me squeeze in one more call here at least, and then I have one more question, then we're going to have to wrap up. Let me say hello to Peter on Long Island. Peter, what's your question for David Pietruzza?
Where was General Rommel on D-Day? And did his absence affect the outcome of D-Day?
He was in transit. D-Day was his wife's birthday. And because the weather was off, because the weather was going to be so bad, the Germans thought, well, we can kind of stretch out and relax. And a lot of generals take leave, officers take leave, they go back for conferences. Rommel goes back to Germany, and his absence is, he doesn't get the word right away. He gets the word that there's been these landings, these commando landings behind enemy lines, but he doesn't, the message gets lost, you know, it's telephone, and things get garbled and lost, and they don't tell him about the beach landing. So he doesn't get the message. He discounts it at first. He doesn't think it's any big thing. It could just be one of these diversionary feints. And one of the things that the Germans are deceived about is they think we have twice as many troops in Britain, on the British Isles, than we do. So even if they land a bunch of, if we land a bunch of guys in Normandy, they think there's even going to be more guys commanded by General George Patton landing at the Pas de Calais. By the time Rommel figures this out around noon, he says, "What a fool I have been," and he wants all the tanks and wow, such landed on rushing towards the beach. But then at that point, because the weather is clearing, we've got this tremendous air support where they only had like 160 planes operational in all of France, and we're pounding them with literally thousands of planes. So they can't move their tanks up to kill us, to get our guys to drive us off the beach during the day. They have to move by night. Again, precious hours lost.
David, we're actually going to have to end it there, but if people are interested in learning more about your World War II scholarship, of the many books you've written, what would you suggest the best book that people pick up if they're interested in World War II is?
Well, I don't know, but it's such a big topic. Mm. I can tell you this. You can get it on eBay, okay? You get some used copies, and they only go for a few bucks. I won't make any money off it. But I wrote a little book for younger readers, not little kids, but, you know, high school and such, junior high, called The Invasion of Germany. And there's a hell of a lot of data in it, easy to read, and the people who laid it out a few years back did a beautiful job with maps and photographs. So to get the big picture and quick, I'd say go to the source, me.
I concur. David Pietruzza, you could check out his website. You can Google him, or you could just go to David, PietruzzA.com. If you get anything close to that, though, in Google, his website comes up. David, SZA.com. David, it is always a treat to talk with you, my friend. I'll look forward to having you back to talk about your latest book sometime soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to do 15 Seconds of Fame next. Be heard on any subject for 15 seconds. That's 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. 15 Seconds of Fame. Meantime, want to tell you about how you can be pain-free. Back pain, neck pain, knee pain, plantar fasciitis. You don't need any of those anymore. Well, you never need any of them, but you don't need to continue to suffer with them. Tennis elbow, frozen shoulder, whatever the case may be. If you are in chronic pain, then the good folks at Trinity Rehab are your gateway to a pain-free life. It's not going to take any drugs. It's not going to take a surgery. It's not even going to take a lot of time. It's going to take 3 5-minute sessions with something called the EPAP machine. The EPAP machine uses non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. They zap you with this thing 3 times for 5 minutes each, and you're virtually pain-free. No prescription needed to get started. Call Trinity Rehab. They have locations all over New Jersey. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, Woodbridge, New Jersey. Call them today, 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977, or go to trinity-rehab.com.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Well, we're going to get to 15 Seconds of Fame in just a minute. 1-800-848-9222. Be heard on any subject for 15 seconds. Four open lines. You can jump on board now. But meantime, look what the cat dragged in, returning to where his rightful place behind the microphone. The guy that we've missed. Actually, I've missed him much more than I expected I would over the course of the last week. Sid Rosenberg is back, looking tan, rested, and ready.
I feel great. The feeling is mutual. We had a station event last night. You weren't there. The first thing I said was, man, I really missed you last night, and I did miss you last week as well. So it's great to see you, and it's good to be back. It's not great to be back. It's good to be back.
How was your vacation?
It was great. That's why it's only good to be back.
Got it. So you guys had fun.
We had a magnificent time. We went to a place. You know, I left here on Friday, Memorial Day weekend. It was miserable here, raining and cold. I know you guys had a washout. When I landed at my destination, it was 84 and sunny. So, and that never changed for seven consecutive days. It was really beautiful.
Wonderful. It's good to have you back.
Nice to be back.
You hear Sid Rosenberg on the WABC Early News. He's going to give us a sports update.
Yeah, I don't want to cut into the time for that jerk off who calls every morning and says, F Sid.
That's right.
Who would never show up outside the studio and send it to my face. So make sure that guy gets on today.
Absolutely. We're going to ask Sid about this boxing match that happened yesterday, more highlights of his vacation, and a whole lot more. It's coming up at the WABC Early News, where Sid does the sports at 15 and 45 after the hour. Meantime, 800-848-9222. It's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Larry on Long Island. Hello.
D-Day 1944. They fought Hitler's National Socialists for freedom and liberty, not for progressive oppression in America or Europe. Freedom and liberty, not socialism.
Russell and White Plains, hello.
It didn't take two nukes to convince Japan to surrender. The Soviet Union was marching down the peninsula. Those two nukes were the worst atrocity in history for geopolitical advantage. Truman's bones should be dug up and burned.
Neil on Staten Island.
When you finally have your first kid, do not ask for naming help from the Borellis unless you want the name to start with the letter J.
All right. Ed in New Hampshire.
Hi, Frank. Great show.
Thank you.
Say his name. W. Allen B. Combs. Radio Graffiti. We want the Floridories. We want the Floridories.
Jim on Long Island.
Yeah, tell Juliet there was no attempted overthrow on January 6th. People who want to overthrow the government don't come in without arms. Hell, she sounds like the fool she is.
Mark in New Haven.
Thanks, Frank. So I was listening to the Memorial Show rerun about the guy with the extraterrestrials. Changed my mind about it a little bit, but I didn't call and talk about that. Henny Youngman talked about the drunk who got hauled into court. And the judge said, young man, you were brought here for drinking. The guy goes, okay, Your Honor, let's get started.
Anthony and Edison.
After the day goes by, I don't appreciate the sacrifice that was made by the last great generation. And it's a shame what those idiots, Democrats, with Sleepy Joe and the rest of these election thieves are doing to this country. They don't deserve to reap the rewards of it.
Thank you, JC. Hello.
See you tomorrow.
Rich in East Meadow.
Good morning, Frank. Welcome back, Sid. Cuomo, you're a putz. You've already lost. Belmont Park is a disgrace. Vaccinated, unvaccinated, you did not ask for one COVID vaccination ID.
Thank you. Peter, hello.
Yes, Frank, this is addressed to you. Would today's high-spirited anti-war activists have a legitimate argument against America entering World War II simply because Hitler had no plans of invading the USA?
I am not going to answer that right now, but I will in the future. We're out of time. Whoa, a lot of show. Happy Monday, everybody. We're just getting started. The WABC Early News is next. Juliet Huddy's got the news. She and I have 90 minutes worth of headlines. Sid Rosenberg returning with sports. We have Joe Nolan with traffic. I've got business. A whole lot of news coming your way for the next 90 minutes. Don't go anywhere. Turn your radio up and bring a friend. To be continued.